Thanks for listening to WRIF Online. The live web stream will begin in 15 seconds.
Hi, this is Brian Elias, president of 1-800-HANSONS. Need new windows, siding, roofing, doors, or gutter protection, but not quite ready to buy? Well, click on the banner above and enter my exciting home makeover sweepstakes. You could win the home improvement of your dreams. Come on, get it done.
The Riff's Phone-In Talk Show on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
Well, thank you very much, and welcome. Another Sunday of Night Call, and we want to get your calls. It's Jolene Jordan back. She had the, you're here.
Yeah, I'm here, and I'm glad to be here.
Yeah. Yeah, you had last Sunday off. You're already.
I'm raving. I'm raging inside. What do you mean? 2 weeks? Wow.
Wow.
A long time.
Our number is 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. Our email address is calltalkyes@yahoo.com. If you're either too bashful or the lines are filled, they're not filled now, so you can come right ahead. Many of you are listening to the WRIF stream around the country and even around the world. It may not last. You may not be able to do it unless something happens. I'll tell you about that in a little while. Big entertainment, cultural, political news. Michael Moore's Sicko has been opening in selected cities, including Birmingham, Michigan. And it played at the Birmingham, Palladium, I think, Julian? Yeah.
There's a couple of theaters there that, both nice.
Everyone so far has liked it, said that the film is probably the best he's done, and they uniformly say it's not going to make as much money as Fahrenheit 9/11, which made almost $120 million, but probably more like Bowling for Columbine, which made about $22
million. Well, you know what, Michael Moore, I think we could say he does not care about that.
Well,
making money's fine, but he doesn't care if he matches it or beats it or whatever.
Only, I would suspect, in the sense that it's a gauge of how well it's doing.
True.
In other words,
great point.
Yeah, Yeah. So the thing that Michael Moore has done for us, after all these years of people bringing the dismal state of American health care to public attention and hardly getting any traction whatsoever, finally, Michael Moore, Michigan's own, Flint, Michigan's own Michael Moore, has created this as a talking point for the entire nation.
Yeah, definitely. But what's happening is, you know, a lot of the presidential candidates, at least we know what they're going to say on the right, but on the left, there are many presidential candidates who are completely staying away from even commenting on it.
Yeah,
you've read about that. Sure, well, you said it to me.
Because none of them are willing to go as far as what's the situation in every other industrialized country in the world. That is a national, universal, single-payer, the government, healthcare system. And here in the United States, I'm one of the fortunate people that through my union and through the station, I have a good health plan.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe that would be the situation where I would keep that, that all of a sudden it wouldn't be my doctor wouldn't have to work for the government. But they could work something out. I mean, all the fears, all of the scare stories, everything like that that you hear from the people that, I don't know what's their solution? 42 million people without health insurance at all, tens of millions more with crappy health care, people getting sent into bankruptcy and into foreclosures because of an illness.
Yes.
And a lot of the auto companies, another industry that just does not have, that can't meet the cost when healthcare keeps rising and rising and rising. So there's a couple of things we could do. Well, I mean, I've said that about Canada. Same with us. Remember, I said that Canada can either have an army or it can have a decent healthcare system. And its healthcare system...
What do you think it needs more, right?
Well, yeah, it doesn't need an army at all.
Right.
And we always get our Canadian friends the call and say, well, they're peacekeepers. Forget it. Forget it. Somebody else will do it. Get out of Afghanistan and disband your army like Costa Rica has. Have you got the Mounties. You got Sergeant Preston of the Yukon.
Right. So Michael Moore.
Yeah.
I'm keeping you focused.
Michael Moore.
The release is, I think it's really important that we let everyone know that Sicko is being released this Friday. And it sounds like what he does is takes individual stories from around the country. And, I mean, if anything, any of the other documentaries you've seen from Michael Moore have ripped your heart out, which if they haven't, then you're a cold-hearted Republican a-hole as far as I'm concerned.
Okay.
All right. But I guess it's just another one that it's tough to take, but you have to take a critical look at what the real situation is. And he's been spending a lot of years on this.
He has. By the way, if you're dialing 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743, Al Slayer, I guess, is not in the room right now because he's got a lot of other duties, including... Oh, yeah, I should tell people.
He ran the live show that was on before here.
So what do you think? He's laying down right now?
No, I don't. I think he's okay. Earlier, he said he was born in 1986. I think he's just fine.
Okay. All right. But in other words, people are you're going to put him on hold.
I am.
Okay. Just say, hold on. Oh, okay. You just got put on hold.
On hold.
Yeah. You got put on hold. But that totally took me off of, what were we talking about before? Michael Moore, Sicko.
Yeah.
But
that's it.
One of the things
and
that...
And then we went into Canadian Mounties, and I brought you back.
Yeah. Sergeant Preston
right.
Of the Yukon.
Okay.
All right. Here's what one of the things that Michael Moore did is that he ran a newspaper advertisement in New York that appeared in this publication called The Hill, a number of papers, listing the names of about 900 lobbyists registered for health care clients. Now, think about that, folks. Think about that, folks. There is 900 lobbyists. 900 lobbyists that all they do is try to create legislation that will be great for the corporations, the healthcare corporations, and essentially bad for you and me. In other words, they want to maximize profits. We have a for-profit healthcare system, and so they want to figure out how can they get as much money as possible out of us as individuals or us as health consumers, right?
Right?
I'm sorry, that's the same thing.
Right.
Or our company health plans.
And for those who are villainizing him, which will happen, and we're calling him the villain for even creating this documentary, he says, if there's a villain in this movie, it's called the health insurance industry of America. To laughter and applause, Moore said he hoped the film would turn into a going away present for industry lobbyists.
Wow. Great.
Yeah.
So what were these 900 guys? Anyways, he listed the names of about 900 lobbyists registered for healthcare clients and invited anyone on the list to a free showing of his film Sicko. This
well,
is in
wasn't
Washington,
that nice of him?
12 of them showed up.
Really?
Yeah. Nine of them refused to give their names.
Oh, well, that's another no big surprise.
Yeah. People have said this is actually the best movie he's done. And when I first heard, I said, well, how is he going to beat Fahrenheit 9/11? And when he announced it was going to be on healthcare, I said, man, ooh, this is not going to be real interesting or, you know, very exciting.
Sure.
But it like all
well,
of his films.
Or sexy, right?
Yeah. Have you seen the ads for it? They show he's in a hospital gown and he's pulling on rubber gloves and he says, this is going to hurt a little bit.
Really? Where, I can't believe that you've seen these and I haven't.
They
you been watching TV again,
no,
Mr. Warby?
No, no.
I
this
mean,
was,
Peter, sorry.
This is okay. That's my dad's name.
I
right.
know.
No, it was in the New York Times entertainment section.
All right. Today. All right. Just checking.
313-298-WRIF. I want to talk a little about what happens to countries where you don't have constitutional guarantees assured.
You mean like here?
Exactly. But gasoline on my corner is down to $3.15 a gallon. In fact, I even saw it for $3.05.
I saw it for $2.99.
Whoa, man. Wow, what a bargain.
Woo!
Yeah, great.
Not.
Yeah.
Let's go back to that old saying. Not.
How about this? A push from Congress and the White House for huge increases in biofuels, such as ethanol, is prompting the oil industry to scale back its plans for refinery expansion.
Yeah.
That could keep gasoline prices high, possibly, for years to come. Do you think they'll do that?
Oh, you know, I'm just going to go out on a limb and say, yeah.
These people are such thieves. And this is all such a scam because it'll work both ways. Bush's oil buddies, of course, will continue to make the super profits, gouging us, stealing money out of our pockets. And as we always say, the people that can afford this the least are the people that have the least amount of money, that things like gasoline represent a much higher proportion of their income.
Oh,
than,
it is so true. I have, you know so many people, Peter, who I've spoken to, who have said, I can't work this job anymore because it requires me to drive here and then to here, and I'm going under.
Also, Bush is a big friend of, what do they call that? Agribusiness, right. I thought there was another bigger word. In other words, the big agricultural producers. That, and so the idea that we'd have a 20% drop in gasoline and replace it with ethanol, that worked for all of his buddies. Oil industry executives no longer believe there will be a demand for gasoline over the next decade to warrant the billions of dollars in refinery expansions. Expansions, as much as 10% increase in new refining capacity. They anticipated this as recently as a year ago. So what's going to essentially happen is we're going to wind up paying more for gasoline. So, but wait a minute, if they're going to replace it with ethanol, shouldn't that expand the amount of gasoline available? Well, no. They're going to screw us regardless.
Was that ethanol that's causing the problems with rising milk prices? I read something about that.
I saw a headline and I thought, I can't keep up with this.
I couldn't even go there either. I couldn't go there. Peter, I don't drink milk anyway.
Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan. Yeah, Mugu.
Yeah.
That's what it's called.
Can we say what we always say about drinking milk?
Oh, go ahead.
Well, we're the only species that drinks the milk of another species.
That's actually kind of disgusting, isn't it?
It kind of is.
Although I love cheese.
I do too. So I guess
maybe that's
we're eating the cheese of
in a way that's even species. More disgusting. You take the milk of another species.
We better stop.
Into cheese.
Curdle it. We better stop.
Let's stop.
Back to the business at hand.
313-298-WRIF. I'm Peter Werby with Jalene Jordan on WRIF, and you go to my website, Peter Werby, WERBE.com. Now, when there's countries that have been identified as the bad guys, right?
The like, axis of evil, you mean?
Yeah, well, exactly. But now it's a quartet or something like that because you have Venezuela. So anytime, can you say the... You can say, I mean, if Chavez in Venezuela farts, it's a story, right? He's, how just crude he is, and all of this.
Sure.
Whereas these brutal, repressive, torture regimes that are Bush allies, like and have been U.S. allies under Democrats as well, like Egypt and Turkmenistan and Pakistan. I mean, all these terrible countries that do awful things to their people and have sham democracies, you don't hear anything about them at all.
That's true.
But there's a front page article in the New York Times today called Iran Cracks Down on Dissent. And it really is terrible. It says, Iran is in the throes of one of its most ferocious crackdowns on dissent in years, with the government focusing on labor leaders, universities, the press, women's rights advocates, a former nuclear negotiator, and Iranian Americans, three of whom have been in prison for more than 6 weeks. The shift is occurring against the backdrop of an economy so stressed that although Iran is the world's second largest oil exporter, it's on the verge of rationing gasoline. At the same time, the nuclear standoff with the West threatens to bring new sanctions. Now, but here's what's going on, though. The hardline administration of President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, analysts say, faces rising pressures for failing to deliver on promises of greater prosperity from soaring oil revenue. Now, here's what he's doing. Now, the United States is pressing Iran more and more and more, fighting two wars on its eastern and western border, one in Iraq, one in Afghanistan. I mean, think about the United States if, say, China was fighting a war in Canada and Mexico. We'd be a little concerned, There's also the United States has allocated $75 million of our tax money to destabilize Iran. That's nice. That's good. Let's destabilize Iran. That'll make things.
But that's not how they're putting it.
No. Well, yeah. Yeah.
Is that they did. How they had.
They announced that they were creating covert. They announced. Get this. They announced. These people are crazy. They announced covert programs. To destabilize. I mean, how covert? It's supposed to be secret, right?
Yeah, true. So they're doing every single thing they can to go over there to Iran. You may lose that bet with your friend Peter that you have. You may just well.
Well, now the government of Ahmadinejad has been using American support for a change in government as well as a possible military attack as the pretext to hound his opposition and its sympathizers. So that the fact that there is internally opposition to this right-wing theocratic government, they're able to suppress it on the basis of these are American agents. They're part of the destabilization carried on by the imperialists and all of that.
So I think what you're saying is that the people of Iran, the civilians, are hurting more because of our threats already without us even going in there.
Now, how can old Ahmadinejad do this? Why don't people have the right of free speech and free press, freedom of assembly? Because they don't have a constitution that has the kind of guarantees that the United States does. I don't think so. Maybe someone knows something about an Iranian constitution that I don't. So it may have it. But obviously, in fact, it would even be worse if they have it and it's not in force. Because you can have documents that don't mean anything. And what you have to have is a functioning, how would you say it, and a functioning things that are being administered on the basis of how they're written to be carried out.
Well, and what's so scary is that you really are describing the shredding of the Constitution
in the United
States of America.
And you have Dick Cheney, who's resisting oversight of his office's handling of classified information. There is something called the National Archives Unit, and it monitors classification in the executive branch, and it objected to the fact that that Cheney has been keeping all this stuff secret.
And he's saying that he is exempt.
Yeah, he says he's not part of the executive branch.
Yes.
Well,
when did that happen?
I don't know, because they just declare stuff.
He's his own planet. That was one article I read. I believe it was Maureen Dowd, that he's now his own planet.
Planet Cheney. Well, David Korn.
Lunacy.
At davidkorn.com says, not an, and this is what he said, this is what Cheney said, he's not an entity within the executive branch. So Corn says, not an entity within the executive branch? What branch of government then does Cheney's office belong to? I'm no constitutional lawyer, but I believe there are only three possibilities. He's no judge. He's not a member of Congress. That leaves only the executive branch, unless, of course, the vice president's office transcends the Constitution. Oh, heck, he says, why don't we just call him king? But that would create a problem. What do we call the president? Well, there are, actually, if you go to Spain, you know, there is a king, King Carlos, King Juan Carlos, and then there's a prime minister, and there may be a president as well, I think. So a lot of those parliamentary countries have both a prime minister and a president. So what's this all about other than, you know, vice president snarly throwing his weight around? Well, when you begin to erode, when you begin to fray the constitutional guarantees, when you say, yes, we can wiretap citizens, we can hold people in violation of everything that has been fought for in the West for the last 800 years, beginning with things like habeas corpus, like bring the prisoner before me and to see whether there's a body of evidence and continue to hold him, that we can torture people, that we can look at our emails, open our letters. Well, that's when the Constitution begins to be nothing. That's when the guarantees in the First Amendment don't mean anything. That's when there starts to be a pattern, not of respect for civil liberties and civil rights, but the shredding of them, that we begin to start going down that slippery slope to where George W. Bush said, my favorite form of government is a dictatorship. of course, if I'm a dictator. Four times.
Yeah. But he right, four times. Thank you, Peter.
He never said it. I don't. He may have said it
four
once.
Four separate times.
But I think he, I don't know whether he said it after September 11th. There. I think he did.
I think he did, too.
This is an editorial in the Los Angeles Times. He says, Cheney's behavior is entirely in keeping with his longstanding views on executive powers, executive privilege, and the divine rights of vice president. He also has championed policies that have shredded American privacy rights in the name of national security with methods that have included warrantless wiretaps, which is an impeachable offense.
And it's still going on.
It's still going on. Email and postal mail snooping, monitoring library withdrawals, mining data on the telephone and buying habits of millions of citizens, and the expanded use of national security letters. But Cheney has been vigilant in defending his own privacy rights, saying that nobody has the right, nobody has the right to look into my stuff or my papers.
Oh.
Yeah. And why don't you go F yourself?
He's gotten to a new level of gall.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, let's. I got a few more things to say, but we've got a call from far away. Here's Sandra in Sacramento, California. Sandra, hi, it's Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan.
Hey,
welcome.
Hi, how are you guys?
Good,
great.
I just was calling because the whole sort of energy thing that's going on. So now we want to switch from the oil companies to the agribusiness. I mean, they're both rapacious, and the whole idea of putting food into my car to drive. I mean, something really obscene about it.
Yeah.
And I'm just, you know, I don't, this whole biofuel stuff sounds, I don't know, I don't, it seems like it's going to take food away from the world hungry to me.
No. They're making so much damn corn.
And the United States is producing enough oil from fast food because not enough people have read Fast Food Nation and figured it out that it's bad for you. Let's do that.
Yeah, but the corn,
more of that.
They had a corn scare in Mexico where the tortilla prices doubled. And
yes.
People were practically starving. I mean,
that's
I'm just
right.
Sort of like, I don't see why they can't use other.
Well, that was because they were manipulating the price of corn. The United States is flooding any number of Latin American countries, including Mexico and including other ones in South America that have just been ruining the indigenous farmers. That's one of the things that drives them into the United States. In fact, things like NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, that Mexico has to allow an unlimited amount of U.S. agribusiness corn. So the Mexicans, rather, who have grown corn for 1,000 years on their own, suddenly are importing corn grown in Iowa. Sorry.
It's all right.
They got enough for everything. Corn, by the way, is a very destructive crop as well.
Yeah, I care more about the indigenous people of Mexico than the people.
Well, they knew how to regrow things. I mean, there wasn't the kind of ruination of topsoil and the heavy use of pesticides and herbicides that's used and genetic modification that's used in growing corn here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right, Sandra, thank you so much for calling in from so far away. If you're a little closer or farther away, feel free to call Jalene Jordan and me, Peter Werby, at 313-298-WRIF. Let's see, here's Mike. Mike's from Birmingham. Mike, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how you doing, Peter?
Doing good.
Yeah, I went to the Ted Nugent concert a couple nights ago over at DTE, and... His music is awesome, but he keeps giving this rant. It seems like every concert he gives this rant about politics and everything. And,
he did
and like,
not.
He referred to Hillary Clinton as a whore. And
did he really?
Yeah, he did. He called her worse than that. But
really?
What letter does it begin with?
I don't want to talk about it.
We'll put you on hold. Will you tell our producer? We want to know.
Hey, he doesn't call himself the Motor City Madman anymore.
What does he call himself?
The Texas Wild Man.
The Texas Wild Man.
Oh, that's original.
Because he's such an idiot. He's such an idiot that he, when Bush was riding this crest of popularity after he'd manipulated stuff around 9/11 and the Iraq War, that Nugent moved down to Crawford from this wonderful ranch he had outside of Jackson, Michigan. So now, of course, he's no longer the Motor City Madman. He is the Texas Wild Man.
Whatever.
Yeah. No, he does good play.
Rock and roll.
Well, but we
rock
should
and roll,
we
Ted.
Should support his right. I mean, I do because
absolutely.
One of the it's interesting. There's one of these right wing creepy talk show hosts. I think it's a woman. What the hell's her name? Anyway, doesn't even matter. But she has a book called "Shut Up and Sing," where because 98% of everyone in the arts and culture and music and rock and roll and symphonies and except for maybe the country stuff and a few, maybe Bruce Willis and Ted Nugent, they're all liberals and left-wingers, right? There's something about the creative spirit and the expansiveness and the desire to look everywhere within the human experience that's missing from the conservative brain because they're just such rigid freaks, right?
Yes, yeah, sure.
I mean, they always say
Bruce Willis is a...
Yeah.
Which way does he go?
Right-wing.
What?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Sorry to break this. But they usually say fascists can't make art. I mean, they do, but it's not very interesting stuff. But you do have, there historically has been, in the 20th century and into the 21st, few people on the right that are good actors, good musicians, good painters, but very few painters, you know.
Yeah. You know, I used to like Van Morrison, then when he played at the inauguration, because it's Dimebag Laura's favorite band.
Yeah.
You know she sold dime bags in college,
right? That's right.
Okay. Anyway, I just like to always reiterate that he performed at that, and it just ruined the whole thing for me.
Well,
that's okay.
But you know what? I still like Van Morrison, and I suspect I don't know if that says anything about his politics. I don't think he's Irish, right? Who knows?
Can you imagine how much money that was?
Yes, I know. That's what I mean.
But I wouldn't even do it for all that money.
But
I write really good songs, too.
Did Nugent play any new stuff, or was it all his old stuff?
Mainly his old stuff. It's funny, there's this one
he closed with Fred Bear. I know that.
There's this one song he played. It was something like, "I sure do like them Girl Scout cookies," or something.
Okay, that's funny. We like that.
I'm like, it sounds so dumb. I don't know. He's got a big country influence. I think the whole country music is on the right wing circuit or something.
He's living in Texas.
What's the line? Why do I think of all the lines from all the songs? When in doubt, I whip it out.
I whip it out. I got me a rock and roll band. Free for all.
Free for all. Right.
Yes, yeah.
Free for all. Yeah. All right. Thank you, Mike. Thanks for calling in.
I'm glad.
Yeah. Yeah. I'd go see Ted.
I've seen Ted, and I thoroughly enjoyed myself.
Yeah.
Every time.
I wonder if...
I just don't want to kill it and grill it with him, okay?
There's a,
no. And I've met him here at the Riff Studios, and he was so gentle and sweet.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he's, yeah, but so. He's slightly crazy.
You think? A little bit, maybe.
All right. Okay. Here's Dustin in Imlay City. Dustin, it's Peter and Jolene on WRIF. You're on the air with us. Hi.
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 Hello.
I just heard tonight that the price of milk is going to be going up to about $4 a gallon this summer.
Yeah.
And that is due to the fact that all of the corn that we're using for these biofuels is depleting from the corn that we're able to feed our cattle with to produce milk.
Oh, well, maybe.
So they pass along the cost to consumers that way.
Oh, maybe, well, Sandra was right then from when she, who called from Sacramento.
Well, this is that ethanol thing I was talking about.
Yeah. Well, I was saying, man, that they just have corn up the wazoo, but maybe there is a shortage. Well, they always got us by the cojones, don't they?
Right.
No matter which way we go, we go, all right, ethanol, how cool. We won't have to fight wars over in Iraq anymore because we'll be burning all this corn oil.
And then it's related to milk. I mean, when I woke up and read this headline, I thought, oh, God, this has just all gone completely mad.
Listen, right. There is absolutely no reason why any adult should drink milk. I mean, that's
I like cereal.
Well, I like cereal, too. I hate to tell you this, but this is probably going to make you...
Gag. Soy milk?
I use soy milk on... Yeah, it's no cholesterol. It, I guess it has some fat, but it's not not animal fat. All right. And I don't know. It might even be more expensive now that I think of it.
Isn't I think...
How much is...
I
have no idea.
I don't buy any of it.
How much is a milk a gallon now?
It's about $2.30 to $3, somewhere in there, I believe.
Yeah. So everything's going up.
It's like a gallon of gas.
It's like a gallon
it's
of gas.
It's cheaper than a gallon of gas, but pretty soon it might even be more expensive.
Thank you, Dustin. Appreciate your calling. We'll be right back. Peter and Jolene at 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. I'll tell you why you are not going to hear WRIF streaming on Tuesday, and if things don't happen, you might not hear this program streaming either. Right back after these on WRIF.
This is WRIF.com.
like I matter to the one I need. I'm so afraid of the guilt you'll give me. I don't belong here and I'm not well. I'm so ashamed of the pride of living. I'm right on the wrong side of it all. Now I'm ashamed.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much. And joining me, Jalene Jordan, 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. Call TalkYes at yahoo.com for email comments. And, oh, yeah, I haven't been looking at this too much. Have you been dealing with this, Jalene? MySpace.com, Night Call Detroit?
I do. I look at it every day. We still have friends. The best, you know, the one thing we should reiterate is if you want to email the show, use calltalkyes at yahoo.com. The one thing that can do is put comments up, and we have a lot of fun ones that people have put up, different, you know, Cheney and Bush, different things like that. But use calltalkyes at yahoo.com for the email purposes mainly.
All right, here's the deal.
And Peter will answer everyone personally.
Absolutely. with our web stream. As you know, essentially, I guess if you're listening to us streaming, maybe we should explain this to the people who aren't and don't know what that means. But through the Internet, you can hear this program all across the country. That's why Sandra called in from Sacramento. That's why we have listeners in Finland and Tasmania and Shanghai and South Korea and where else? All around the world. All around the United States, Mexico. And
I have a friend in Uruguay, I think, who was listening tonight as well.
Yeah, really? And then, I'm forgetting his name, too, at the South Pole. Were you here then when he sent me a sweatshirt from the South Pole?
Yes, he's wearing his Riff shirt at the South Pole.
That may all be a thing of the past. If this impending royalty rate increase is implemented, it would lead to a virtual shutdown of Internet radio in the United States. Thousands of webcasters, which includes WRIF, and the owner of WRIF is Greater Media, Inc., whose headquarters are in Boston and owns three stations in the Detroit market, including WRIF. But they sent out a memo that says, the day of Greater Media, Inc. announces it will temporarily take its radio station's webcasts offline on Tuesday, June 26th, in support of a day of silence for webcasters. The Day of Silence initiative was organized by Radio and Internet Newsletter, and that you can go to my website, Peter Werby, W-E-R-B-E, peterwerby.com, because their website is kind of long. But the deal is that, let me see if I can simplify this. This Day of Silence, this is from their website, is an encore of a successful media event that small webcasters organized on May 1st, 2002 in response to a similar royalty rate ruling from a copyright arbitration royalty panel 5 years ago. But now they are going to put up rates so high that it could be that 150% to 300% of revenues for small webcasters, and some of them could be us could be paying as much as 1,000%, and it would make it literally economically infeasible for like WRIF to continue webcasting.
Oh, that would be so highly unfortunate.
Yeah, at least though we have a radio signal, right?
Yes, we do.
Yeah, but there's a lot of people who just do webcasting. Our friends at radiopower.org, for instance. Boom, gone.
Many. Think of the thousands of people who do that.
And I don't get it. I always understand how people want more royalties for what they're producing, but
is enough enough?
Well, but if it just blows it all off, if everybody says, later on, we're not going to do it, it's kind of shooting yourself in the foot, right?
I would think so.
So we'll see. So on Tuesday, some of the stations, and I don't know what WRIF is going to do, are going to be having public service comments that say why this is happening, why you're not listening to Riff Rock and Roll. All right, we got a number of emails in at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. This is from Frank, and he says, "Hi, Peter. I think we should wake up and realize we're no longer the United States of America." The punctuation is weird here. "That it was signed off on 2005 by Bush, Fox of Mexico, President Fox of the president then of Mexico, and the Prime Minister of Canada. Laws are being written up to govern what is the North American Union." Now, this is one of these, it probably talks about this at Snopes, SNOPES.com. And there's people that are really worked up about the fact that there could be not the United States of America, but in fact the North American Union. You know, right? Mexico is part of North America. It's not part of Central nor South, certainly not South America. Now, here, I'm going to rile people up. What would be the difference? What, you know, let's forget about the idea of that of these racist concepts of these brown hordes overwhelming our country, and just sort of park that from, you know, your brain for a minute. What would be the difference with, I don't think the Canadians would want to do it, but I mean, who'd want to be a part of a country that's at war all the time and that spends the vast majority of its tax dollars that instead of helping us have this country that could be solve all of its problems, instead spends hundreds and hundreds of billions, trillions of dollars on the military industrial complex. So, A, this is a total rumor, and B, I wouldn't care. Let me know what we could have, and then you're saying, wait a minute, they'll take all our jobs.
Oh, can you? I can hear people's heads spinning right now.
How about this? If they're part of the North American Union, we'll have a $10 an hour minimum wage.
Okay.
All right. So if you're in Juarez or Veracruz or someplace like that, you're making $10 an hour. So why would anyone want to leave? Because, I think I was saying last week, the Mexicans that are coming here illegally are the most ambitious of the people that whose livelihood in Mexico has been destroyed by things like NAFTA, getting their rural life being destroyed by the penetration of U.S. capital, that no longer could Ford say, hey, we're taking your job, and now they're doing this at Delphi, cutting people's wages in half. So instead of making like $56,000 a year, they're going to make $28,000 a year working in some miserable industrial factory here. So as it is, we're going on a race to the bottom. I mean, this is what this Delphi settlement is part of. The millionaires running it, they're doing fine. They keep getting their millions. The stockholders will get their millions. And, of course, workers in Detroit, and the jobs are not going to be taken by illegal Mexicans or even legal immigrants. They're going to be continued to be worked at by your neighbors and my neighbors, except they're going to be worked at half the price. So this is a frontal attack on labor standards and our standard of living on working people that have entered the middle class by virtue of three generations of labor strife, and it's just the rug's just being pulled out from under us. You say, well, why is Mexico, that's an interesting slip. Why is Michigan having such economic problems? All Jennifer Granholm. Well, the industry leaves so it can pay people in Mexico not even a living wage, and on the other hand is going to hear for the people that are staying, the industry that remains, they're going to cut their wages in half. Who's really responsible for this? And if you're saying, well, look at Delphi, they're in a bad spot, and who signed these damn contracts? If these guys are so rich, why aren't they smart? If why couldn't they see in advance that perhaps they were, quote, overpaying their workers? They were forced into it. Nah, they weren't forced into it. They're terrible businessmen. So forget about this North American Union stuff. It ain't real. Don't you have an email there also?
I do. Hello, Peter and Julene. This is Tracy Brown from Port Huron. You know my husband, Robert, a lot better than I do. Anyway.
Wait. What?
I don't know. I'm not sure what that means.
Tracy,
maybe,
I do not know your husband.
Someone who used to work here. We have listeners. Anyway, as she says, As my husband was reading his weekly MySpace blog to me, he mentioned that Dick Cheney, the so-called vice president, obtained 5 deferments from military service so he could avoid having to fight in the Vietnam War. I know my husband's hatred of this regime is very strong, and he may exaggerate a little bit, but is he right on this? Hell yeah.
Do you guys talk?
Well, you could put your computers together.
Yeah. Well, just go, if you, I assume, well, since you sent us email, you can, one of the
he
things.
Got out of, he, yeah. He got out of it.
Was it?
Your husband is right.
Let's see. Well, maybe we can even quickly do that. He got a number of deferments. There's a phrase, which anybody who's heard this program over the years knows, is called chicken hawk.
Chicken hawk.
And these were the men of military age that I don't think this, you
never
know what?
Went.
It is off. Yeah, I'm sorry. Keep me unfocused. Yeah, that scammed, that supported the war. Now, here, people
not
like,
only supported, pushed, and made it happen, Dick Cheney.
Well, they were young then.
I'm talking about this time around.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So they could have fought in Vietnam since they supported the war, but what they wanted was somebody other than them to do it. Man.
Yeah.
Well, I got a lot
and
here.
And they still do.
Let's see. Bush was AWOL. We know that. Mm-hmm. Where? I'm looking down here.
Yeah.
I was trying to.
Robert
says
5 deferments.
Yeah, Robert is right. I was. There's
ding, 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 ding.
I was smart
she
enough
got
to
a
get.
Prize for
this
him.
Is what he said. He said, I was smart. Maybe let's see if that. No. God damn, none of these links work anymore. Oh, I can't say that. Sorry. I take it back, folks. Yeah. That maybe this is a fake quote. I don't know. But he got 5 deferments. Cheney did. What a
slime ball. So, Tracy, you need to believe your husband a little more.
Well, one of the things that happens.
He's doing his research.
Since both Jolene and I also do rock and roll shifts, that you frequently, do you get this? Over the years, I've gotten this too, is that women call up and they say, I was having a debate with my boyfriend or their husband.
Uh-huh.
And I say, you're correct. I'll tell you, let's give a lowball estimate. Of the last 30 women that have called, and they're arguing about who did a song.
Okay.
They're arguing about who did a song. I've never heard of a case where the man was right. Because the woman will say, yeah, that was Foghat. The guy say, Foghat, that wasn't Foghat, that was blah, blah, blah. You know, they're written, like, totally dismissive and, you know, like, what does a chick know, man? She's not a rock dog like me.
Right, yeah. I've had it the other way
really?
Around, happened the other way around, yes.
Boy, am I missing something? What in the world is E85?
I that's a good question.
2 callers want to talk about E85, unless this is some code that Slayer is going
Slayer
for.
Code.
Hey, Ryan from Auburn Hills. Hi, you're on the air. You're on WRF with Peter and Jolene. What's E85?
How you guys doing?
Good.
E85 is it's basically a shortened name for the ethanol 85.
Oh, okay.
Gas out of corn.
All right, cool.
But basically what it is, I mean, it's using all this corn, and you're right, there's a huge surplus of corn across the world. And all they're doing is just—it's just another way to take more money out of us from other things.
Well, yeah.
Hey, we're using all this corn, so now the cows need, you know, we're taking.
So we can feed the people
the
cows. So we can, yeah.
But a big problem with the E85 is Brazil was one of the first nations to really, really get into it with their vehicles.
Right.
And they run into a huge problem because of how humid it is there. The E85, it draws a lot of moisture into the engines of the vehicles,
uh-huh.
And it's causing a lot of mechanical problems with their motor vehicles.
Wow.
So, that's another thing you got to look at with that stuff.
I don't know. It's discouraging.
Let's go back to a primitive way.
Well, one of the things,
let's dream.
And I don't know if this could be done. I mean, since we've got all of our communities are based on the internal combustion engine, but if we could have small decentralized areas of even great cities where most of the time we could walk and some of the times we could bicycle, that there was great mass transit, and also have cars available, because if we want to drive, as we say here in Michigan, for those of you listening elsewhere, want to go up north,
right.
We could do it. Yeah, or but you know, in the 1880s and the 1910s, they had trains running over to South Haven up to Traverse City.
And the state of the train system is just in shambles, isn't it now?
Yeah, I mean, it's not.
It could be utilized.
It ain't the best.
So much more.
All right, thank you very much, Ryan. Also talking about ethanol 85. I know exactly what that is.
E85.
Here's Mike in Clarkston. Mike, hi. You're with Peter and Jolene on the air. Go ahead.
Yeah, how you guys doing?
Doing good.
Great.
Good. Hey, the one thing about the E85, I think there's a little bit of a misconception that the corn that's being used is actually the feed corn or like the fruit of the corn. What they're actually using is actually the stalks. The caller before me actually hit on South America. I believe it's Venezuela is the first country to really they use sugar cane. And this stuff is kind of almost like it's kind of like it's brewed, almost like a beer or any other type of alcohol, like whether it be from potato or any a fibrous type of a product.
You can use any biomass.
Like
I mean,
hops.
Hops or hemp.
Right. Exactly.
Hops. What made you think of hops?
Who knows?
Don't start. I think it's Willie Nelson runs his tour bus on hemp oil.
Well, the thing I think about is the way that we're it's going to have an effect on the price of corn, and I understand that initially, but the people who are actually behind the drive on this are all of the oil companies, the people who are building these huge refineries. There's a couple of them in Canada. I mean, BP, Conoco, you have Sunoco, you have all these, the big companies that are normally oil companies are the ones who are building these huge refineries to come up with this E85.
Sure.
And maybe there will be an initial bump in corn or whatever it is that there'll be an effect of that sort, but in the long run, the E85 is going to be a good thing for this country, because wouldn't it be nice to know that the farmer in the middle of Iowa is the person who's making money instead of the emir in the middle of the Middle East?
Well, yeah, for sure, except what we have growing most of the corn is the local emirs. I mean, the family farm is just this quaint little bit of nostalgia. It's all agribusiness that's doing the most of it. But and also, I mean, how much corn do we want to grow, and how much of land do we want to turn over to this soil eroding stuff? I mean, there's a major problem in the United States with soil erosion, topsoil erosion, as it is. I don't know. I hesitate, and I obviously, if you're running a talk show, there's a tendency to always sound like you're the expert on this. This is a complicated issue, and I'm interested in looking into it more. So I appreciate, Mike, your ideas, and thanks for calling us.
You know how little I knew about E85. I thought they were talking about that super-duper machine they had in the movie Stripes. Do you remember that?
No.
The M-something. Someone write in. They know what I'm talking about.
let's see. We do, in fact, have time for some other calls. And I don't know. Oh, yeah, I said hemp oil. I was wondering, how did I want to start reading stuff about medical marijuana? I'll do that after the top of the hour break. Let's get another call in, though, before we do that. On line four, Slayer, what's up with that? There's nothing. There's no name there. Is that a... should I be going to that
mystery
line?
Mystery guest?
Is it a mystery guest? Is it Ted calling in from
Is it Ted wanting
Crawford?
To talk about kill it and grill it?
Kill it, yeah. All right.
Give us some recipes.
Let's go to Chris in Royal Oak. Chris, Peter, and Jolene on WRIF. So are you. Go ahead.
Hey, how are you guys doing tonight?
We are doing good.
Awesome.
All right, listen. I want to tell you about the future.
Sure.
Oh, my gosh. This is
horse,
big.
Horse race
the
results, I hope.
Big.
Oh,
okay. All right, now, number one, we have to feed the cows. Well, we have to feed ourselves. Number two, we have to feed the cows. And now with this ethanol production, deforestation, okay? Mm-hmm. You know how many trees are going to have to be cut down to grow the corn that is going to have to fuel the world?
That's what
for ethanol
the whole
production?
Argument for vegetarianism is a vegetarian.
No, listen, I'm talking about... We have to fuel our vehicles with. Now, listen, there's many ways to produce gasoline, say, for lack of a better term, for vehicles.
Yeah. But
ethanol is the answer that has been predetermined and determined. Do you know how many trees are going to have to be cut down?
Well, I don't know. I mean, that's what we've got to. We can't just sort of make assumptions. There's a lot have been written on this, and this is one of these things that I've been interested in looking into. And I think that I'm going to get a guest on about that.
Isn't that that whole diet for a new America, the Robin's heir that became...
Oh, yeah. You need, to get 1 pound of beef, you need 100 pound of corn and all
this
that.
This is what I'm trying to get to.
But I think Chris's point is well taken. I mean, if all of a sudden you're going to stop our addiction to oil, which is nonsense...
Right. Then you take away all the trees.
Yeah. Well, but I don't know. I don't know if they're going to start cutting down forests so they can grow trees.
No, I think they were cutting down the forest.
Forests to grow corn
so they could feed the cows.
How do I do this show by myself? Hey, we got to take a break. Thank you, Chris. And a lot of more people want to talk about ethanol and corn and E85. Anybody know this stuff? And not making assumptions we would have to. Is there a surplus? Is there not a surplus? I don't know. I mean, naturally, I don't like it very much when I don't have all the answers. But one of the things is I count on you. You know, right-wing talk show hosts, they got all the answers, but themselves. And they're,
no matter what it is.
Yeah, their callers are idiots. Whereas between all of us, we have the answers. More of it when we come back on WRIF. If you want to call in the meantime, 313-298-WRIF. It's 313-298-9743.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Seen Junior's grades. Hits the street.
building, WRIF.com. Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much. It's getting cold in here. Jolene just put on her sweatshirt. What is with this place?
It's midnight.
Yeah, so now it's getting cold. I've got shorts on and a little shirt here. We were talking earlier about Willie Nelson's tour bus runs on hemp. Jay writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Willie Nelson runs on hemp.
And this is how bad it is. I didn't get it. No. I'm so literal. I'm thinking of the bus. You know? Okay. Oh, God.
E85.
Good joke.
We're talking about ethanol 85. Think about Andrew writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Think about the growing demand for resource corn. It will not sustain a demand. End the drug war and elect Ron Paul, a president. Lower taxes and government involvement and elect Ron Paul. Ron Paul voted against the Iraq War and the Patriot Act, not to mention he is being blocked by both parties. One final one. Roderick, how about maybe one or two emails a show, Roderick? Okay. I love engaged listeners, but
someone did answer my question about the movie Stripes, though.
Oh yeah,
because there sometimes a sense of pop culture is fun.
I'm totally out of it. So I have no idea.
E85. I was like, I immediately thought of that vehicle from Stripes, that just big badass vehicle that they went around in. It was the EM50,
the kick-ass vehicle from the movie Stripes.
Who wrote that?
What?
Who wrote in and told us that? Do you know?
Yeah. Steve.
Thank you, Steve. I knew someone would answer
Steve
me.
Steve did. Yeah. Stripes. What was that? I mean,
well, let's not go to
okay.
You should see.
Oh, no, wait a minute. I'm lecturing one of our loyal listeners about sending me too much email, where he always has good comments. He says the U.S. government should increase the CAFE standards, the corporate average fuel economy, which is the average fuel economy for companies' cars or their trucks, to 80 miles an hour by 80 miles per gallon by 2010. And you go, well, yeah, why not? I mean, why do we allow this to keep going on? I mean, everything from pollution, I mean, this epidemic of asthma and oil spills, and worst of all, in a way, I guess, are these wars that have to be fought for control of oil.
For what? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, for what? At 1 a.m. Eastern Time, if you're elsewhere in the country or the world, please do the math. We are in the Eastern Time Zone of the United States, and... Oh, yeah. You don't even know this. Joining us...
I do. Let me guess.
What?
Scott Ritter.
Scott Ritter, the former U.S. Marine who voted for Bush in 2000. He was a U.N. weapons inspector in Iraq. And
he was the head weapons inspector in Iraq.
Yeah.
And when all of that was going on with Bush saying about the weapons of mass destruction, Scott Ritter was one of the biggest voices on television, if you watch those shows, against it and said there are none. This is a big interview, Peter.
Well, now he's talking, actually, this is, you'd almost say, a narrow focus, because the book he's just written is called Waging Peace, The Art of War for the Anti-War Movement. So he's, I said, most people aren't in the anti-war movement. What, maybe one half of 1% of the United States population?
Probably.
Yeah, but I'll leave it to you and the listener to hear what he says at 1 a.m. Following that, Felicia Kornbluh has written The Battle for Welfare Rights, Politics, and Poverty in Modern America. Check that out. And that's all of this. You can link to this on my website, their books and stuff like that. Peter Werby, W-E-R-B-E, PeterWerby.com. What else is on here? Oh, yeah. The Iraq Veterans Against the War are carrying out a bus tour, mostly through the Eastern Seaboard in Georgia, I think, too. Let me see. What does it say here? I can't read it because I printed Georgia to New York. We're holding barbecues for soldiers at bases from Georgia to New York, the IVAW. Just like there was the Vietnam Veterans Against the War, now there's the Iraq Veterans Against the War. And I think it is IVAW.org. I believe it's .org. And you can go to my website or their website and find out the schedule as well. All right. Sorry,
good.
I'm good. Disconcerted. I'm looking
public
at my own
service.
Website. Yeah. 313-298-WRIF. Wow. Can you see the what people want to talk about? It is ethanol.
Amazing.
All right, so we'll go in order of how long people have been waiting. From Port Huron, here is Chris. Chris, it's Peter and Jolene on WRIF. Thank you for joining us. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you guys doing?
I'm doing good.
All right, so I just want to give a little quick comment because I don't know too much about E85, but I do know that if you take all the oil that we use to make plastic products around the world,
yeah,
and you get that made from corn, you solve the problems.
Yeah,
plastic. There's more in that than there is in our cars.
Well, I'll tell you what. I was just talking with someone about this. There, I've worked for years with a newspaper called the Fifth Estate. You can go to fifthestate.org. And we wanted some plastic bags. And we got this catalog, and it said 10 million plastic bags in stock.
Oh,
this was one company.
Wasn't that horrifying just
yeah
to read?
So if the planet makes it through the scourge of disposable plastic, it's going to be amazing. There's something like 1 million styrofoam cups a day thrown into the oceans.
Hey, Peter, do you ever notice, like, all the plastic bags in the trees?
Weren't we talking about this? No, I never.
Yes. I tried to get you to do an interview with the guy who interviewed this contraption to get all the plastic bags out of the trees, and you still don't get it.
I don't. But in any event, you were right there, Chris, and I was thinking that that plastic is really this curse the way it is used in such a mass form. In other words, it could be used for any number of things, in car parts or anything that's not going to be immediately disposable, like garbage bags, right?
Right, even rubber for tires.
What do you mean?
The rubber for tires can be made from...
Rubber?
A lot from petroleum products made by... plastics and rubber-grade ethanol. And there's one company on the verge of doing it.
Really? Well,
yeah.
One of the things, though, when you have this essentially plastic tires, they're not all... Are they a combination now of natural rubber and... what would it be? Plastic? It doesn't... All of a sudden...
I know someone in this audience knows
that. What the hell are tires made of? Do you know?
I have no idea.
Wow. Anyway... When do you get new tires? When do you buy new tires?
Right before winter.
No, well, you don't
when
do it every...
When they're bald.
When they're worn out.
Right.
Right? Where is the wear out? What happened to... How do you know? You don't see big hunks coming off. Well, you do on retreads from big trucks.
Right.
But there's this microscopic wearing down every time your tire rotates, and that goes into the environment. And... hundreds of millions of tires have worn out, so all that crap is in our environment.
And
it's
we
scary.
Wonder why the rates of cancer, just another chemical
in the environment.
Right.
All right, Chris, thank you very much. And let's see, here's our next caller. It's Pat in Milford. Pat, it's Peter and Jolene. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, Peter. Hey, I'm an engineer, and I kind of have the ethanol as a sort of like a side hobby for... investing, and I tell you what, there's a
lot
of things.
I mean, there's actually somebody going to talk to us that knows what they're talking about? All right, this is a first.
Actually,
go ahead.
Actually, let me just straighten out a lot of things. First of all, there was a guy that called earlier and said that they don't use the fruit part of the corn.
Yeah,
that's
he said they use the stalk.
They use the kernel of the corn for ethanol. That's the basically what you need for it is sugar. To make alcohol, you need sugar, and whatever gives you sugar, which is pretty much found in any plant around, you can make alcohol out of.
But I was going to say, you can make it out of grass, you can make it out of hemp, you can make it out of, for a while they were growing, all of a sudden I can't remember, some other kind of grass.
Switchgrass, they talk about. Yeah, there's all kinds of things. Here's the thing, though. In any kind of analysis of any kind of energy source, you got to look at not just the politics, but just say, hey, how much energy do you get out versus how much do you put in?
Okay.
And if it isn't a multiple, you're barking up the wrong tree. Like current oil wells are somewhere between 100 and 1,000 times the energy is extracted because it's, you know, essentially, you know, just coming out of a hole in one spot in the earth, and you get a tremendous amount of energy out versus how much you need to put in, you know, transporting it, refining it, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay.
Ethanol from corn is not a, is a, is a, is a losing energy proposition. You have to put more energy in to produce a certain amount of energy if you consider the entire enterprise of the activity, the fertilizing, the farming process, the transportation, et cetera, et cetera. Now, there's places where it can work, like the back end of a sugar company, or say at the, as a side thing to an Archer's Daniels Midland, you know, where they process tons and tons and tons of corn for other products.
Mm-hmm.
There's all kinds of opportunity there, but to grow it as a crop, to deliberately truck it somewhere to make it into a fuel is not a, a good investment. The
but
only
you're invested
it works,
in it. Why are you, know, you why are you invested in it? For what purposes?
Well, I was thinking about investing in it, and I'm not.
Okay.
Oh, okay.
In fact, the investments I have in it.
Okay.
And it's very seductive because, okay, on one hand, it's like, ooh, wow, we can be energy independent, which isn't true. And two, it's like, ooh, it's environmentally clean. Now, it is environmentally clean, but if it takes more than a gallon of gas to produce a gallon equivalent of ethanol, then you're, all you're doing is transferring where the pollution occurs. Okay. Now, also, you mentioned about tires.
Sure.
At one point in time, years ago, Denver had some real strict regulations, and it turned out the tire particulate was about 1 to 2% of their entire air pollution.
All right, and what are tires manufactured from?
Oh, there's no rubber left in them.
Okay.
Wow.
Well, not, probably, not since,
really?
Probably not since World War II, right?
No. You don't have the old rubber plantations doing. Now, they're actually, I shouldn't say it, rubber is being used in the world, but not in general tires. It's too risky.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Pat. I appreciate your comments. And here, I think somewhat echoing the same sentiments, Andrea writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. She says, I'm an atmospheric scientist, so I'll put in my 2 cents about ethanol. Basically, from an atmospheric standpoint, ethanol from soybeans or corn or anything else, excluding hemp, I don't know why, it still has nearly as much as a negative impact as oil. Not only does it take a lot of energy to produce ethanol, which is just what our caller said, burning regular fuels like oil and methane, but ethanol emits only 13% less greenhouse gas than oil. It produces almost as much NOx. What the hell do I know about this stuff? This is what causes ozone pollution in the summer in the Midwest and the North and year-round in hotter climates. Ethanol is just a stepping block that can be skipped like the laser disc. Huh? While all these companies are spending money trying to produce ethanol, hydrogen energy, 90% of our universe's hydrogen, is being ignored. The only issue with hydrogen is it produces water vapor, which is still a greenhouse gas, and is more abundant than any other.
She was talking about that big laser disc that was invented, and they only used, remember those big, huge ones?
Yeah, sure.
That's what she
okay.
was talking about.
The difference is gaseous water condenses easily into drinkable water, whereas carbon dioxide does not.
Okay, so where
I think
does this put us? Back to ground zero.
Well, yeah, I think what we got to do is we got to create situations where we just don't have so many vehicles on the road.
Yeah.
That's and while we're doing this, you go to third world countries, and it's like they're so polluted, and the idea that somehow that they're going to completely convert off of oil, I mean, I think it's somewhat of a dream.
Right.
313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. Here's Clayton in Whitmore Lake. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment about the ethanol.
Sure.
You know, I heard that they say, you know, ethanol, they're talking about deforestation, basically, but what is the main product of Michigan? You know, it's corn, pretty much. And I don't think that has any bearing on deforestation or anything like that. I mean,
I don't think it's going to cause deforestation.
They're also talking about South America with the deforestation.
Well, I heard the guy that called in earlier talking about how they're going to take down wildlife and this and that. But, you know, the major cash crop in Michigan is corn.
You know, it wouldn't surprise me. I don't know why I keep going back to this, but it could be hemp. You know, there's a lot of states where hemp, illegally grown marijuana, is actually the largest cash crop. But let's call it the largest. It probably is probably the largest legal crop. All right, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. I think I just want to talk about drugs. I think that's what's going on here. I can tell.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. Your show.
Yeah, Governor M. Jody Rell of Connecticut vetoed a measure today that would have legalized the use of marijuana for certain medical conditions. She actually is a breast cancer survivor. And she says she completely sympathizes with the well-intentioned goal of alleviating pain and suffering, but legal alternatives are available.
You know, when I read this, the note that I wrote next to that was, ugh.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a woman who had breast cancer. Now, I don't have breast cancer. I don't think I do. I'm not a survivor. You know, I don't have it in my family, but I've had a lot of friends who've had it.
Sure.
And the pain they went through, and the ones who had it and smoked marijuana were way better off than the ones who didn't. So for this woman, especially, it's just a big ugh.
It's all political, obviously, because it's still the demon weed.
Right.
And it's particularly useful for people suffering from multiple sclerosis, cancer, and AIDS, and other diseases.
Oh, yeah.
And it would allow them to grow marijuana in their homes with a doctor's recommendation and a state permit. And one of the things that they say is that it's just a stalking horse for the legalization of marijuana for recreational use.
Right.
Well, so what business does the government have of telling us whether or not we can smoke flowers that'll change our consciousness? I mean, obviously, people shouldn't drive, but that's the same thing with booze, right?
Well, yeah.
Hello.
I should say even more so.
Well, here's the dangerous drugs, I guess. The South Carolina treasurer was indicted on Tuesday, the state treasurer, on federal cocaine charges. The treasurer, Thomas Ravenel, I guess it is, a former real estate developer who became a rising political star after his election last year, is accused of buying less than 500 grams of the drug to share with other people in late 2005. He's a 44-year-old millionaire charged with distribution of cocaine. He's facing a maximum of 20 years in prison. Guess what political party he belongs to?
Is he a Republican?
He's a Republican.
500 grams is kind of a lot of blow there.
I don't know.
I mean.
Yeah. Well, this is less
from
than.
From what I understand of these things.
I don't know if it means that it's, you know, at 499. It could be, you know, over 500 is one set of penalties and under. In other words, if he was going to distribute 3 grams, that would be less than 500, right?
Now, well, just don't make me do math, Peter. That's all I've ever asked of you on this show. No, I'm just kidding. You know, Mr., what did you call him? Ravenel, whatever it is.
Ravenel, yeah, I like that.
Is also the state chairman for Giuliani's presidential campaign.
You know, Giuliani is such a piece of work.
You know, I don't know why I find that so funny.
Well, he's all tied in with these crooks.
He really is. I mean, what was that one guy's name that was always by his side?
Keurig.
Bernie
Keurig.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
He was a mess and a half.
He was tied in with the mob and everything. And, and that was who Giuliani had pushed to be the first Homeland Security director.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just a pack of them. As I think you should, well, maybe it's already been copyrighted, but pack of psychos.
You know, right. You know, here's a name we have not, I don't think we've mentioned this. Maybe I did once because I was imitating him. We have not mentioned the name of Bush. One time.
Oh, you know, well, just on one note, there's that new show called Little Bush. Have you heard about this?
Tell me. It's
a cartoon, and it's Bush, and they're making fun of him. So if anyone's seen that, please let us know if they enjoyed it. I think it just started. What else?
Well, here, I'm free associating. When I was in Caracas, there were posters all over the Hilton Hotel. Yeah, this is an upscale hotel that said, what, am I saying this right? Bush Asesino, which... That's not
really?
Like an a-hole. No, that's not like that or anything.
It's an assassin. To JFK?
No, yeah, it was no.
But they're saying he's an assassin.
Yeah, he's an assassin.
Okay.
And I had him with a Hitler mustache, and it's so weird being in this fancy Hilton hotel. Like I went up to see one of the guy we've interviewed a number of times, and so I went up to his room, and you could overlook the pool. Of course, you could see the slums on the hills. Mm-hmm. You know, the contrast always in those countries. And so I go down the lobby, and there it says, Bush Asesino.
Oh,
it's weird.
Yeah.
How did I get up on that? Oh, the Bush. Yeah.
Well, now you're going to get all the Chavez folks calling you.
Yeah.
313-298-WRIF.
Bush vetoed the stem cell bill, I'm sure, driving his popularity. If it can go, I mean, there's a certain
any
point.
Further down?
Yeah, it's 26% now.
Yeah, which in the margin is plus 3 or negative 3, so I'm bringing him down to 23. Yeah.
And what could Vice President Snarly, what could his... what possible ratings could
he's
have?
He's got to only have like 9. That's what I think. He's like 9. Yeah. Hey, Peter, have you ever known anyone who has utilized stem cell?
I don't know. I
know two people
really?
Who have been saved by using stem cells in this country.
Wow.
In the last 2 years.
That's amazing.
It sure is.
Well, Bush has said to people with everything from Parkinson's to multiple sclerosis, mm-hmm. screw you.
Yeah,
because
cancer, screw you.
He doesn't want, he talks about he would not support the deliberate destruction of human embryos.
Mm-hmm.
So all these embryos that have been created in for these fertility clinics, and so they have, I don't know whether it's tens of thousands or millions or whatever, but you know what they do with them? They destroy them. They destroy them there. So these would just be utilized. So he still... I mean, he's lost even a lot of his right-wing wacko religious base, obviously, mm-hmm. if you only got 26% left, and because many of them support stem cell research because they know the afflictions that the human body has. A billion years of evolution, you'd think we'd be hung together a little better.
And how powerful the stem cell is. It's amazing. Bush also said, I made it clear to Congress and to the American people that I will not allow our nation to cross this moral line. Well, you know what I want to say here? Whose moral line are you talking about? Because you're not talking about mine, and I know they're not talking about yours, Peter.
And this is a guy who has lied, cheated, who runs probably the most corrupt regime since Ulysses S. Grant, another Republican.
And he snorted half a pay raise.
When he was a kid. When he was, I don't know.
Well, it's not funny, and it's not a joke, but sometimes a little comic relief is the only place we can go.
Is it you? No, it's not you, is it? That has it bumper sticker 1/20/09?
No, but we were talking about that.
Yeah.
Those are showing up. My latest bumper sticker, I have none right now, but was Blondes for Peace.
There you go.
Thank you very much.
But, you know, bumper stickers.
1/20/09.
Yeah. All right, never mind. Doesn't mean I got to remember.
Have you seen more? Have you seen more of those?
Yeah, but I know what I was going to say. The World Can't Wait. There's an organization called WorldCan'tWait.org,
right.
And they're pretty militant. They say drive out the Bush regime, and we can't wait. I mean, the world and the United States and Iraq and our soldiers.
We can't wait, but you know what's so unfortunate is we have to wait.
Yeah.
Because there's not going to be an impeachment. I mean, I know a lot of people are pushing for it, but it's not going to happen.
I don't think it's going to happen.
You know that.
I don't want to. Oh, boy. Look at that. Got all cut off here. But now, this is from the Associated Press, the Marilyn Marchicioni, the Associated Press medical writer. They estimate now, I mean, we talk about there's over 3,500 U.S. troops being killed, and they're being killed quicker and quicker and quicker. There's been some... unfortunate records set, a two-year high, or a two-month high.
Larger numbers, more rapid rate.
Yeah. And now they estimate, depending on how you count them, she says, the number of America's war wounded is between 35 and 53,000. And what's happening to the Iraqi people? I mean, it's just amazing. And these headlines here.
Yeah, who cares about them, Peter, right?
Yeah. Pentagon report criticizes troops' mental health care. Troops struggle with finding therapists. Oh, yeah, here.
Lives ruined. How about that headline?
Doctors say Iraqis' mental health suffering. Do you think?
Oh, imagine living in those conditions?
Yeah, do you think of, put this like in kind of context, Chinese are going to liberate our country from Bush and they're doing here what the United States troops are doing there. Don't you think we'd be suffering a few problems?
Absolutely.
I mean, can you see? I mean, one of the traumatic effects that American troops have seen. I mean, just people. I mean, there's one guy that there was a he was, they were going to give him a dishonorable discharge. He was there for the first day,
yeah,
and saw somebody had literally been cut in half by machine gun fire.
Mm-hmm. And he just said, puked. "I can't do this."
He says, "I can't do it anymore." And so they were going to,
which would be me.
Yeah. Well.
Yeah.
All right, let's go back to...
Hey, listen, that crazy Pat Robertson was on TV this morning. Just one more note before we go back to the phone.
Talk about right-wing wackos.
And he said, I can't believe they let him on these shows. Anyway, and he said, well, you know, America's going to end anyway if we pull out of Iraq. It's just going to end. So, and this nutball, it's you and I who should be on those shows, not that nutball.
Here's Josh in Berkeley. He wants to talk about Little Bush. What's up with that, Josh?
Dude. Hi. I'm just listening to you guys, and...
Hey, cut your radio completely off, will you?
Turn your radio off.
Because we're...
Yeah, well, I was listening in, and you were talking about that show, Little Bush, and me and my friend were just laughing, because that's an amazing show.
So you watched it? Cool.
Yeah. They made fun of Bush so much, and if you don't like Bush as president, you should definitely watch that show, because it's awesome.
What is it on? What channel?
It's on Comedy Central.
Yeah. Oh, okay. All right. We'll check it out. And it's cartoon, huh? Animation.
Yes. It's a cartoon.
All right. Yeah.
And it sounds just it's Little Bush.
We'll solve the problem. Thank you, Josh. Thank you for that.
I knew someone would know that too.
Here's Jason and Wayne. Jason, it's Peter and Jolene on WRIF. You're on the air.
Yeah, I wanted to make a comment about the ethanol earlier, even though we've changed subjects.
No, it's okay. We're totally ADD on this bus. Go ahead.
It's okay. Anyway, Pat, a hold of you guys ahead of me, and he hit the nail on the head about switching energies. If you're spending too much on making the ethanol,
right?
Then, well, what's the point anyway? Now, another caller before I even called made a comment about the excess moisture in the engines. Not only that, I drive a truck with a big V8 and a carburetor, and it really reduces the gas mileage. So if you're spending more energy to make this new energy and it's causing you to waste more energy to use this new energy, what's the point of it anyway?
Well, I agree with you, but it's what I said. They'll still be producing lots of oil and a lot of gasoline and charging us incredibly high prices. And then Bush's buddies in the agribusinesses, the giant firms that control so much of corn production in this country, they'll be selling it as well. So the fact that it's not, quote, efficient only affects sensible people, reasonable people, but what they're interested is how much money can they make out of it. They're not interested in the environment, obviously. They're not really interested in getting us off oil because they have no real intention to do that.
So if we could all be more like Willie and smoke a little more weed and use the marijuana oil for our fuel, then I think we'd be all right.
There you go. There you go. Yeah. Thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Bye-bye. We can take another call, though. I find these things out of nowhere. This was in the business section of the New York Times. Airbus, which is a big firm like Boeing that produces these big airliners, a big competitor.
Yeah.
For Boeing, Louis, I can't remember how you say it. Those very strong French cigarettes, Gauloises. Gauloises, isn't it? Yeah. So I think it's Louis Gauloises, the co-chief executive of. And now again, I don't know if this is EADS or EADS, the parent company of Airbus. Could have his pick of invitations among dozens of parties during the Paris Air Show, the giant industry gathering this week. But on Saturday night, Mr. Gauloises went to pay his respects at a gathering held by members of the Mobile City Council of Alabama and the Mobile Airport Authority. We are linked to Alabama, says Mr. Gauloises, the lone French accent in a room full of southern twangs, including state legislators and Alabama's two senators. We are almost married. What the hell is this all about? Well, the reason for Mr. Gauloises' charm offensive, the troubled European aerospace and military giant wants to land a $40 billion contract to provide 179 aerial refueling tankers to the United States Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
Folks, this is the military-industrial complex at work. This is this transfer of our great national wealth that you and I produce out of our labor every day, if we're lucky enough to have a job, and then it is transferred to the government, which then transfers it to the military contractors.
Hey, so for all of you who hate the French, here's a reason for you war supporters to love the French.
Well, Governor Bob Riley of Alabama said, "All I ask is that Eds be treated fairly and that the tanker decision is based on merit. Don't give demerits to this company because they are associated with a French plane." Hey, the French were right about, remember they were the cheese-eating surrender monkeys and
yes,
weasels and stuff like that. Well, Jacques Chirac was absolutely 100% correct.
He was.
And George W. Bush was absolutely evilly wrong. Right?
Look at all these phone calls, Peter.
We
better move along.
All right. One thing we got to move along is do these, and we'll be right back to get your calls.
This is WRIM.com.
Don't
WRIF.com. More Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much. And joined by Jalene Jordan for our final segment. Andy's listening in Cooksville, Tennessee on the internet. He's a tight. It was one of my rare listens and enjoying the show. Since listeners want to talk about ethanol, what about biodiesel? See, this is what I mean. I just don't know about all this. Obviously, corn would have to be a biodiesel, wouldn't it? But anyway, there's a link here, treehugger.com. And then it's got a long stuff on it. I think you could just go there. But there's somebody, actually a colleague of ours, who just told me that her husband's truck runs on from this falafel place. And he says it's illegal to do, but he does it anyway.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow, that is very interesting.
But Andy and the rest of you listening on the internet are not going to be able to listen any longer if this rate increase of this royalty rate increase from the copyright arbitration royalty panel goes into effect. It will virtually close down internet radio and also will make streaming by big corporations even impossible. Big media firms.
It's horrible.
Yeah. So there's going to be a day of silence this coming Tuesday, June 26th. Webcasters are turning off their streams to send out what they call an urgent distress call. If this doesn't make a lot of sense to you, go to my website, Peter Werby, W-E-R-B-E.com, and you can click on it and go down a little more on that. I've often, and Jalene as well, have recommended A People's History of the United States by Howard Zinn. If you don't know who that is, his history book now has sold 1.5 million copies.
He's an amazing historian, yeah. And writes from the people's history. And, you know, he was huge in the civil rights movement. And this guy, he is just, he's on a pedestal.
Yeah. Absolutely incredible. But he's written now a young people's history of the United States.
Really?
Like if you want to...
I can infiltrate my Republican family. I have this niece and nephew. I'm so terrified going to be that same thing. I think, I'm writing this down.
I don't know if I made my point a little earlier, and then we'll go right back to our phones, about the fact that the European company, the French company Airbus, wants to get this contract for $40 billion to provide 179 aerial refueling tankers to the United States Air Force. Why in the hell is the United States military this huge? Why does the United States military have to have the scope of this magnitude that we are spending $1 trillion on weaponry and
expansion,
everything
up the wazoo?
Absolutely, because it is the military-industrial complex.
Yeah.
See the documentary, Why We Fight. All right, let's go back to our phone calls. Let's see, where are we? Jerry in South Lyon has been waiting very patiently. Jerry, hi, it's Peter and Jalene. You're on the air. Jerry, hi.
My bus, it runs on hemp. Oh, sorry.
There's a song.
Yeah, go ahead.
Hey, first off, Pat from Mulford was about 100% right in everything he said about ethanol.
He had a lot of info, yes.
Okay, one of the important things is that if it takes so much energy to produce it, it's sort of a zero sum, so why are we bothering?
It's kind of like your recycling theory, Peter, mm-hmm. Isn't it?
Only that, it's 30% less efficient than gasoline. So that's another thing.
Well, they don't run. Like in Brazil, do they run on 100% ethanol? Will cars do that, or do they just always mix it with gasoline products?
They run 100% ethanol in Brazil. There's some engineers that I work with that are from Brazil, and they said that's all they run down there.
Wow.
Plus, you got, Indy racing cars that run on ethanol.
Are they?
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
And I watched that whole damn Indianapolis 500. Didn't know.
Want to hear my Indy 500 joke?
Yeah, and if you would have watched the race today,
you have one?
Yeah. They had commercials about that.
I don't even remember. Was there an Indianapolis 500 race this year?
There was, and I didn't watch the... I guess I must not have watched the commercials. I don't know. I was just all into it because there are a bunch of women in it, and you know me, and I get all excited about...
All right, here's a joke. This father comes up to his son and said, "Son, all you ever think about are politics, all these political prisoners and this demonstration and that demonstration. Don't you ever think about anything else?" And son says, "Like what?" He says, "Like sports." And he said, "Sports." He says, "Like what?" He says, "Well, what do you think about the Indianapolis 500? He says, "Not guilty."
Nice one.
Thank you very much.
Peter.
Appreciate your call. Here's Mason in Lincoln Park. Mason, it's Peter and Jolene on WRIF. Thank you for joining us. You're on the air.
Hey, Peter. I wanted to talk about the recent banning by the state attorney general of the sex offenders from the website MySpace.
Fill us in on it.
Well, what the attorney general did is he looked at the list of sex offenders and then gave that list to MySpace and said that he thought that they should be kicked off. And I think that the state should go further than that and that we should be banning the people on the list from using the Internet or any instant messaging stuff that they could be contacting minors and doing inappropriate stuff with.
I don't know. Can you enforce that? Is it enforceable?
As far as I know, they've done that with people who have committed crimes on the Internet, such as fraud or stuff. They can keep you from accessing the Internet, or if they find out that you're using a computer, you can go back to jail or something. So it is enforceable.
Yeah, you know, one of the things, the Internet has allowed a lot of fantasy to trip over into reality because they just busted. How many, do you remember that earlier this week, Jolene, that they busted all these guys internationally? They had these child pornography rings that was centered in England, and they actually had, they actually freed some children. It was just, I couldn't even read the article. It was so disgusting. And it's just so important that people draw lines. I mean, you can fantasize, I don't know, maybe, I'm not even sure this is 100% true, but you can fantasize about anything, right? But as long as you keep it in your little old brain of your own, and it doesn't become determinative of your sexual interest externally or, you know.
God, isn't everyone over Internet porn anyway? God.
Are you serious? It is what? That we
so
know,
over it.
That Internet porn.
Did I say that out loud?
has a revenue gross greater than all the professional porn.
Does it ever lose its zeal? Come on. It says, I don't know.
I don't know.
I guess not.
All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate
and I'm not
your call.
A prude, by the way. I'll throw that out there.
All right. Brad from Detroit. Brad, you're on WRIF. Go ahead.
Hey, how's it going?
Going good.
Good. What are you guys up to?
Well, just, I don't know.
So much.
I'm about 5'10 and a half. 5'2".
Yeah.
You're
5'2".
Well,
good.
I'm 5'2".
Wow.
I'm glad I'm almost 40 and I'm 2 foot. But anyways, no. No.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry.
I
got to behave because we're morals and values and we're Irishmen from Detroit. No, what I call for is Detroit's been doing a lot of things. Riff has been doing wonderful things, and we need to keep it going. We need to keep the positivity-ness, and we need to, I know we got the Lions. They're going to go to the Super Bowl hopefully next year or the following year.
Sure. Dream on.
No, I like this. It's an optimistic message. Remember, I was the president of my optimist club in high school, Peter.
Really?
We need people like this.
I was the president of the pessimist club. All right, Brad, the almighty riff. Thank you so much.
Thank
Bye-bye.
You for your positivity.
Here's Gary calling in from Indiana. Is it Corydon, Indiana?
Corydon.
Corydon. Okay, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, y'all been talking about... you know, all the military industrial complex and all the oil companies and all this kind of stuff, all these interests that are able to run things with our government. And I think, you know, what it boils down to is, I forget now which senator it is that introduced legislation, but, you know, to do public financing. And I think, you know, essentially that's the only way that we're ever going to get our country back.
You mean public financing of elections?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I just don't see that it's gonna that anything's gonna change if if we don't get all that money out of politics.
Well, absolutely. In fact, Michael Moore, in an interview in the Detroit Free Press today, said that now that the Republican senator, the right-winger Rick Santorum from Pennsylvania, was defeated, which was very nice to see, but now Hillary Clinton is the largest recipient of healthcare industry lobbyist funds.
They're terrified of her because of her plan to begin with. I mean, you know, back when she was in charge of doing that to begin with.
But wait, Gary, no, they're not. Here's the point, that they're not terrified of her, that they are lavishing.
They're all tied in.
They're lavishing lots of money on her, maybe as figuring, whoa, this woman could wind up to be the president, and we want to be part of the people that are buttering her bread, so to speak.
Make a whole bunch of money.
Yeah, exactly. I think she scared the bejesus out of them when she was first lady.
Right.
So
back
now
in the early 90s.
There's a real possibility that she could be the president. They are terrified of that, and that they're giving her money hand over fist.
Indeed.
And thinking that's going to influence. And you know, the sad thing is that...
It will.
They will.
Of course.
Now I had another point real quick because it came up after I called. The caller before last, I think, or whatever, was talking about the sex offender thing. What people need to realize is that there really are two different classes of sex offenders, because you know there are people that I know who were, when I was like 20, I see there was two, in fact, when I was 22 years old, you know, they were 22. I went to school with them. They had girlfriends who were 16.
Uh-huh.
And they ended up being in prison as sex offenders, and now they wear that label for the rest of their life.
Yeah.
And then there was a case of a guy that was in, I think it was Ohio, who he had sex. It was a similar case. He was 20, I think 21 at the time, and had sex with somebody who was 16. It was his girlfriend, and they put him in as a sex offender. And his psychiatrist told him after he was released, they kind of messed with him in prison, I guess. Anyway, they told him to write out his fantasies, you know, on his computer or in a diary or whatever. And they arrested him and put him back in prison because he had put that in a journal on his computer. It didn't go online. It was just in his computer. But the probation officer come and they done this thing and checked it, and they put him back in prison. So there's two sides of this whole sex offender. I think if they, you know, somebody that has sex with a child, you know, they need to be thrown away.
Well, you know, I'll tell you, Gary, there are people that have been caught peeing in public that wind up on the sex offenders list because of what they call it is public indecency.
Thank God, I'm glad I never got caught.
Yeah.
I mean, it's ridiculous. I mean, you know, look, there are, you know, if you've ever had to go to a public park and they, for some reason, have the restrooms closed, what do?
That's right.
You know, and what, are they going to arrest you? They do. You know, I mean, not in some places, other places they do. I mean, I think a lot of these countries that have kind of, you know, they've kind of become more realistic about the age that people start to have sex. I think that's a much better thing. But
I do indeed. Thank you, Gary. Thanks for calling in from Indiana.
Folgers coffee can. That's what we always used as a kid.
Really?
Wow. The road
trips. You know, there was a musical that I saw.
Urinetown.
Urinetown.
Gosh, I'm reading your mind.
Now, let me see. I remember when it was. It was in February of 2002.
We saw it in New York.
Because we were in New York for the big anti-war demonstration. 1 million people saying no to George W. Bush. Mm-hmm. Imagine that. 1 million people. You know what? In about 12 minutes or so, we're going to be playing an interview I did earlier in the week with Scott Ritter, the U.S. Marine. Yeah, he was
former chief U.N. Weapons inspector.
And also, he was an aide to General Norman Schwarzkopf in the first Gulf War.
Ooh.
As well. So he's a complete opponent of the war in Iraq, and was in the lead-up, because he knew there were no weapons of mass destruction. And that's what I mean. Some of you, you know, that old thing about won't get fooled again, you watched Bush or you watched Condoleezza Rice or you watched Powell lie in the United Nations or you saw these guys with charts and ex-generals and all that, and you believed all the crap that they said. Now, how come I didn't believe it? Well, like I wasn't in Iraq or anything, but you had alternative information, and that's what's important. You had the information from people like Scott Ritter, so you knew that, that there wasn't any weapons of mass
destruction. And sitting around watching Fox News all day, by the way.
Yeah, bad idea.
Really bad for your brain.
Bad idea. You know, and this, I mean, this is sort of a segue from what we were talking about, peeing in public. This almost is comical, but it is so horrendous. As Christopher, this is called Ohio Drawn into Executioner ID Debate. This is a thing about the people that are part of the execution team and the doctors in Ohio are kept, they're kept secret. They're identified.
Anonymous.
But listen to this first line. At Christopher Newton's execution by lethal injection last month, it took 90 minutes and at least 10 stabs of the needle for the execution team to find a vein. The procedure was so drawn out, the staff paused to allow Newton a bathroom break.
Unbelievable. Now, I've heard a few of these happening. Now, I haven't heard of this case, but flawed system?
Yeah, no, it's not working very well. Although still, I was surprised. Although shrinking, majority of Americans still favor the death penalty, even though most of them say, no, it doesn't deter it. I think it is a sense of vengeance, yeah. And again, the United States are the only...
Closure.
Country. Yeah, yeah. Although Michigan, to its credit, has never had an execution because it's embedded in the Michigan Constitution that there shall not be, the state shall not execute anybody. And it happened because there was a mistaken execution right at the time Michigan was about to become a state.
Oh.
So they
that's when that happened.
Yeah. Okay. See, the 38 states that have the death penalty executed 53 people in 2006, almost half of what it was in 1999. So it's dropping. 70% of those surveyed said they did not think reform should totally eliminate wrongful. Wait a minute. 70% of those surveyed said they did not think reforms would totally eliminate wrongful convictions and executions.
Mm-hmm.
So we've found out in the last 15 years, 87% of the people believe an innocent person has been executed in the last 15 years. And 58% think there should be a moratorium on executions while wrongful convictions and wrongful death sentences are investigated, yet the majority think there should be.
Another great place for information on that is deathpenaltyfocus.org, which is B.J. Honeycutt, otherwise known as Mike Farrell, who is the organizer, whatever you call these, the head of this organization, vehemently against the death penalty and an activist against it as well.
Sure.
What a nice guy
he is. He is the best. Since 1973, now remember, last year, where is it here? Or 2006, 53 people were executed. In the last 35 years, is this right? 34 years, 124 people have been released from death row after evidence of their innocence was uncovered.
Right.
So we're not executing a huge number of people, yet at least we know 124 people were sent there, you know, incorrectly.
Right. And I think most of them were when Bush was governor and in Texas. There you go.
He was whacking them and stacking them.
Loves it.
But I had this sitting around for a while, that the wife who killed her pastor husband?
Yeah.
60 days she's getting.
Yeah, she is.
Oof.
Well, you know, who knows what went on behind those closed doors. Some of those right-wing religious fanatics turned out to be the Ted Haggards of the world.
Yeah, she had something. Oh, yeah. She testified.
He made her wear, like, high heels and things.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Made her.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, they also hit and kicked her.
Right.
And let me see. Where is this? They claimed that they had been caught up in a swindle known as the Nigerian scam, which promises riches to victims. I mean, what
things you get on the internet.
People?
Yeah.
But she said during her trial that her husband hit and kicked her, forced her to look at pornography, and demanded sex she considered unnatural.
Right.
Jurors were shown a pair of tall platform shoes and a black wig, Winkler said she was pressured to wear during sex.
Oh, God.
Maybe because her hair was dyed blonde.
Ugh.
They had to wear a black wig.
Don't even know where to go with this, Peter.
He was a popular preacher at the 4th Street Church of Christ in Selmer, Tennessee. I wonder if that's anywhere near our listener, Andy, in Cooksville.
You know, if I didn't want to wear the wig and the heels and I couldn't take it, I would just divorce the damn guy.
Instead of shooting him?
Yeah, well, yes.
Those husbands.
I don't believe in those in shooting people anyway.
What's that thing? Man,
know, come on.
You can't live with them and you can't shoot them.
Right. You know, that's a little drastic.
All right. We got to go. I'm sorry if we've left people stranded, but we are... That's it.
And thank you to Jeremy, who we want to welcome to the show. He's going to be answering phones for us here and there. And also thank you to Al for always doing the extra work that we need him so much to do.
Above and beyond. So we'll talk next week. Oh, wait a minute. What's next week?
It's Sunday, and we'll be here.
No, no, I know. But we probably are not going to be working the official. It's not January or July 3rd, is it? What is it? I can't even.
It's the 1st.
We might not be working.
Okay, well. We'll find out.
Yeah. We'll go to my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.
If not, we'll miss you.
All right.
And we'll be back.
Stay tuned for the interview. Scott Ritter, ex-Marine, UN weapons inspector. Incredible interview.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Pleasure to be with you. As anyone listening to this broadcast over the last 4 or 5 years knows how much I opposed and continue to oppose the war in Iraq. We've had lots of authors talking about the issues involved, everything from terrorism to weapons of mass destruction, how prepared the United States was, how the expectations of what Bush and the others anticipated was wrong, all of it. And now we are sort of stuck. There is an anti-war movement. There is great anti-war sentiment. The majority of people would like disengagement from that morass in the Middle East. But how in the hell do we do it? We're fortunate to have a man who literally has had his foot in both camps. He's Scott Ritter. You may remember that he's been on this broadcast twice before. He wrote Iraq Confidential in 2005, and we interviewed him. Target Iran. 2006, last year. Scott Ritter was one of the UN's top weapons inspectors in Iraq. He was there on the ground between 1991 and 1998. Before working for the United Nations, he served as an officer in the United States Marines and as a ballistic missile advisor was to General Schwarzkopf in the first Gulf War. And it's a pleasure to welcome him back, Scott Ritter. Welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
And the book is Waging Peace, The Art of War for the Anti-War Movement. Well, a small minority, the American people, are actually engaged in the anti-war movement itself. Is this a book that's fairly narrow in scope, just sort of a how-to for activists?
No, actually, it's a how-to for citizenship. I mean, it strikes me that, you know, a lot of people will say, we've got our opinions about Iraq, et cetera, but we're not part of that anti-war movement. Wow, what an absurdly unpatriotic thing to say. That's like saying to a firefighter, we're against fire prevention. You know, we want buildings to burn down.
Yeah.
You know, you're not against the firefighters. You're not against what they're doing, but you certainly don't want fire. And, you know, to say that you're part of the anti-war movement in no way says that you're against the troops. You're against those who, when called upon to do so under the proper circumstances, wage war. But I think every American should be anti-war and, you know, should be part of the anti-war movement, just like every American should be anti-fire and practice sound fire prevention. It just, to me, seems like, you know, the actions of a sound citizen.
Now, Scott Ritter, as I mentioned in my introduction, you were you served in the first Gulf War. You were a U.S. Marine. You were an advisor to General Schwarzkopf at that time. And as I'm sure you know and remember, there was an anti-war movement at that time in 1991. Sitting where you were in during that period, in the early 90s, what was your perception as a Marine to the people that were protesting that war?
Well, you know, it actually hits home rather personally because some of the anti-war activists at that time were my own relatives. I remember being in Saudi Arabia on the eve of the initiation of the bombing campaign. You know, AT&T was kind enough to set up phone booths that we could go and call home for free. And I got through right at the time when there was this big anti-war group pounding away on the drum of peace in hope that their chants and the sounds could waft across the atmosphere and make it over to the Middle East, and, you know, everybody would drop their guns, hold hands like candles, and sing Kumbaya. It didn't work that way. My mind was focused on the mission at hand. But you know what? I was grateful that people actually cared enough to do something. I mean, it would have bothered me more if people were at home tuning into the Super Bowl or watching an NFL playoff game or just going about their lives. And it would also bother me if people were cheering me going to war. What, you're going to cheer me to die? Hmm. You're going to cheer me to take someone's life? To have American citizens say, hey, we want you home safely, to me made me feel good. Again, at the end of the day, when I hung up the phone, I didn't hang my head and say, darn, not everybody's behind us 100%. I erased it from my mind because as a military professional, I had a job to do. I could really care less what people were doing at home, but it also, you know, gave me a little bit of warmth knowing that they cared enough about me and the others who were out there to actually get out there and do something. It didn't bother me at all.
Scott Ritter, one thing I've been very remiss about, we're going to talk about your book, Waging Peace, The Art of War for the Anti-War Movement. As a warrior, as sometimes GIs I know call themselves, I wonder if some in the anti-war movement, and I kind of got that with the chanting thing and all of that, would saying, wait a minute, you know, we have great respect for Scott Ritter, but he applying these principles of war just sort of perpetuates that sense of conflict. Tell us why we should have the Art of War, named after, of course, the great philosophical treatise of Sun Tzu on the war, on how to practice war. Speak to that a little. I mean, why war to fight war?
Well, first of all, we need to, I mean, I use the Art of War because it is a recognizable term, being derived from Sun Tzu, you know, Clausewitz on war, you know, Jomini wrote the Art of War. There's a whole host of military thinkers over the years have addressed this issue, and it's not about taking a bayonet and jamming it in somebody's gut. That's not the Art of War. The Art of War is the art of organization, the art of preparing yourself to achieve victory, decision making. And if the anti-war movement or progressives for peace, whatever they want to call themselves, whatever label is appropriate, rejects this notion, then what they're really saying is, we don't want to prevail. We don't want to succeed. We want to fail. Because they need to recognize that whatever they're going to call it, whether it be war or conflict, and I emphasize the term conflict in my book, they are at odds with an element of our society here in the United States that is pro-war. There is an element out there that wants us to be engaged militarily abroad, who supports the policies that led to this conflict and supports policies that could potentially lead to new conflicts. So if you're going to be the anti-war movement, I would imagine you'd want to stop conflict. You'd want to prevent America from getting involved in unnecessary conflict. And therefore, you must recognize that you are yourself at conflict with this other group. This is ideological warfare, and you better be fighting to win. You better be involved to achieve victory. And therefore, you might do well paying attention to the thinking of those who are professionally inclined towards victory, and that is the practitioners of the art of war. Again, it's not about killing, it's about organizing. It's the notion of strategy, of operations, of tactics. I keep hearing people say, we have a strategy, we're going to have a demonstration. Well, excuse me, that's not a strategy. That's a tactic. And as Sun Tzu says, you know, tactics without strategy is just the noise before defeat. And that's what the anti-war movement has been experiencing, is the noise before defeat. They waste a lot of money, resources, time, and energy by having little one-day demonstrations here, there, and everywhere. But they're not linked to an overarching objective. And believe me, their ideological opponents have an overarching objective. And if one only takes a look at the pro-war, anti-war scoreboard, pro-war side sort of winning the game.
Yeah, one of the things I'm sure anybody in the anti-war movement would say that the pro-war forces always have a leg up because they have the ear of the mainstream media, which is we've lately been calling the MSM, whereas it always seems as groups that begin on the margins that are marginalized by the mainstream media and by the ruling politicians always start at a disadvantage and to some extent have to reinvent the wheel.
Well, and that's, again, that's a reality that has to be dealt with, but it's not a reality that cannot be overcome. I only point to the experience of Cindy Sheehan outside of Crawford, Texas a few years ago. If the anti-war movement wants to claim that Cindy Sheehan's protest did not have the ear of the mainstream media at that time, they're dead wrong. She caught the attention of the entire nation, if not the entire world. The problem wasn't the mainstream media. The problem was the anti-war movement that wasn't prepared to capitalize on this. Here they punched a gigantic hole into the armor of their ideological opponents. Everybody was focused on them, and they were unable to deliver the goods. They weren't able to have a follow-up plan. They couldn't organize for success. And as a result, the Camp Crawford issue or Camp Casey issue and went away. Cindy Sheehan herself was allowed to drift off target so that instead of talking about her status as a mother who lost a child, she's standing side by side with Hugo Chavez in Venezuela shouting anti-American slogans. And if that's not designed to turn off the majority of Americans, I don't know what is. But that's the problem with the anti-war. They come up with excuses. Oh, we don't have the mainstream media on us. And no, you're just not organized. Because believe it or not, the anti-war message is one that is fully embraceable by the majority of the Americans if it could just be packaged and delivered appropriately. It's not that the mainstream media rejects the anti-war message. They just aren't willing to go out and project radical theology, radical ideology, which, of course, is what happens when you take a mother for peace and put her alongside Hugo Chavez in Venezuela and chant anti-American slogans. It's not something that is conducive for broadcast during prime time. Whereas if they had stayed on message, a mother who had lost her son, demanding from the President of the United States, the Commander-in-Chief, to explain why her son died, that is a pure message that resonates effectively across the entire spectrum of American society. But they lost focus because they don't practice the art of war.
Scott Ritter is my guest on the Peter Werby Show. Waging Peace is the book, The Art of War for the Anti-War Movement. And it's a Nation book. You can go to, where is it on here? Nationbooks.org. Or you can go to my website, Peter Werby, W-E-R-B-E.com. And I'll have a direct link to the book as well. As we said earlier, Scott Ritter, The Art of War, the famous treatise by Sun Tzu. What out of there do you take and say ought to be applied to activists or any American that wants to end the war? What do we learn from that? How old is it? A couple thousand years old?
Right. Well, I didn't just focus on Sun Tzu's treatise. As I mentioned at the beginning of the book, I talk about my personal experience as a warrior, somebody who was trained in the art of war. And I talk about how the Marine Corps in the 1980s went through a revolution of thought, where we embraced something we called maneuver warfare. And we adopted Sun Tzu as a model. We adopted Clausewitz as a model. We brought in an Air Force colonel named John Boyd. And, here's a man who does fighter pilot stuff, but we brought his philosophies in and applied them as well. And it was a radical transformation of how the Marine Corps was going to fight the enemy on the field of battle. And the key elements, again, were differentiating between strategy, operations, and tactics, and the notion of linking them together in what we call the campaign, so that we're not just fighting one battle in isolation with another. We fight a series of battles that are all linked to achieve an overarching objective. We talk about leadership. We talk about communications. We talk about logistics support. And you can say, well, that's fine and dandy as a Marine, but what is the anti-war movement? It's a movement that is seeking to achieve an objective across the entire spectrum of American society. So it's not about fighting a battle in California or having a demonstration in California or having a demonstration or event in New York or Texas or Detroit, Michigan, or anywhere else. It's about linking all of these together so that they have a synergistic impact, so that there's actual progress, measured progress being made in shifting the mindset of the American people. Because again, we come back to one of your initial questions. Is this something that the majority of Americans care about? Well, yes, they do. They're just not organized. The anti-war movement hasn't made inroads into the mainstream American society to convince the American people that their cause is worthy of embrace. That's one of the major issues here. And if you read Sun Tzu, it talks about winning over the hearts and minds of the people, that you can't wage a conflict. And again, I emphasize we are engaged in an ideological conflict here. You can't wage a conflict independent of society. You have to get society involved, and the side that has society you know, supporting them in the largest numbers wins, especially in a democratic society like America. It's a numbers game. The side that can bring the most people on board will win at the polls. We'll have elected representatives who are doing their bidding. And again, the anti-war movement just hasn't locked on to this reality. It still believes that they can operate at the grassroots level independent of any central organization. They believe in, you know, what they call representative democracy, where everybody has a say. We're all equal in this thing. Hey, you know, 1,000 people come together. Nobody's in charge. We all hold hands. It just doesn't work that way. You have to actually have some sort of hierarchy. Somebody's got to be in charge. And this is what I try to point out, that the side that organizes more efficiently will have the edge when it comes to conflict, whether it's conflict on the field of military battle or the conflict in the field of ideological battle. And with the anti-war movement today, they need to come to grips with the reality that they are waging ideological conflict. They may not be waging it, but trust me, their ideological opponents are, and they're prevailing.
Scott Ritter, I'm sure you read Cindy Sheehan's, or at least know of it, her so-called resignation from the anti-war movement. How did you feel about that when you either read about her doing that or read the statement itself?
Well, you know, Cindy Sheehan and I have met many times. I have a lot of respect for her, especially in the early phases of Cindy Sheehan's, anti-war posturing. She, I believe, drifted off track. She was she surrounded herself with people that I believe poorly represented her original ideology and poorly represents what the anti-war movement should be about. But that's neither here nor there. What I felt was sadness, because here is somebody who actually was the general at one of the greatest battles that the anti-war movement fought. That's Camp Casey, this woman, this brave woman who stood outside of Crawford, Texas, holding a president accountable for his actions, the ultimate expression of American democracy. And here she is now, a few years later, and she's destroyed. She's financially destroyed. Her morale is destroyed, physically exhausted, and abandoned by the anti-war movement. You know, she was nothing more than a pack mule to the anti-war movement. They just piled more and more and more on her until her back finally broke. And it's the harshest indictment yet of the sad state of affairs in the anti-war movement. You take people who are Cindy Sheehan's ideological opposites. You take a Paul Wolfowitz, for instance, a man who is, you know, who's a double loser in my book, a man who is deputy secretary of state, you know, created this war in Iraq, and then he goes over to the World Bank and fails egregiously there. This man will never want for anything. His ideological allies will take care of him forever. He will have speaking engagements lined up, etc. They just take care of their own. Cindy Sheehan, this brave general who fought the Battle of Camp Casey for the anti-war movement, is being abandoned. And worse, they're abandoning the one person who could best tell us how Camp Casey came about. It's one of the points I make in the book, that we need to capture what occurred there and find out what worked and what didn't work and see if we can replicate this over and over again, especially with a movement that says they have a hard time capturing the imagination of the mainstream media. Here's an example where they did just that. And the person responsible is being booted off to the side by a movement that used her, abused her, and now is just rejecting her. It's a sad state of affairs.
Well, you speak, and I'm not arguing with you, speak disparagingly of these forces within the anti-war movement, but on the back of your book, Waging Peace, published by Nation Books, it says Scott Ritter was struck by the sincerity of the vast majority of those who call themselves anti-war and impressed by their willingness to give so much of themselves in service of such a noble cause. There seems to be a bit of a contradiction of the way you're characterizing.
No, not at all. There's a difference between individuals and a movement. I don't even have to grab a dictionary for that one. And I can be impressed with the individuals, and I can be disparaging of the movement. It's like talking about a football team. Give me a football team that's 0-12, hasn't won a game. I will be disparaging of that organization, but I will never ridicule the individuals who go out there and practice every day and try and make something good happen on the field.
And
what we have in the anti-war movement is a whole bunch of individuals and small groups who truly believe in what they're doing. And they have failed to come together as an organization. And we have a number of organizations that call themselves the anti-war movement, and they're not doing a good job.
What do you think, to some extent, we're talking about the sort of the elite of the anti-war movement, the people that are most in the public eye, and certainly there's small anti-war groups in Detroit, there's, you know, Grand Rapids, Lansing, that have nothing to do with Camp Casey or Cindy Sheehan other than admiring her and her forthright stand. They're sort of at the, you know, they're not involved in this process yet. There's very little linkage. To the extent that they're a movement is only in that they're calling for the same thing, the end of the Iraq War. They're not like linked organizationally.
And there's the problem.
Yep, exactly.
There's the problem. They're not linked organizationally. How do they expect to achieve anything? Their ideological opponents are linked organizationally. Their ideological opponents have found a way to get their ideals manifested in public policy, so that their voices are heard by elected representatives. And this is the thing. I mean, you know, I keep traveling around the country. I spent a lot of time in Detroit. I spent a lot of time in Lansing. I've spent a little bit of time in Grand Rapids. I hope to come back to Michigan frequently because it's a wonderful state. It's actually your ideal ideological battleground state because it's full of, you know, very rock solid conservative Americans. And, you know, if the anti-war movement wants to have a chance to prevail, it's got to find a way to make significant inroads into this bedrock of American society. Most Americans aren't your radical progressive liberals. Most of your Americans are just, you know, staid conservative people who have, you know, good sound principles and values. And the anti-war movement has to find a way to align its message with these principles and values. And Michigan is the perfect place to do it. But they don't have the organization. And that's one of my main criticisms, is that you have all these well-meaning people. I mean, the fact that Grand Rapids, Lansing, Detroit, and the rest of Michigan can't come together in a single overarching political movement, that they haven't found a way to consolidate planning, training, resources. Why is Lansing doing something that Grand Rapids is doing? Why don't they let Grand Rapids do it and Lansing does something else, or vice versa? Why don't they reinforce each other, support each other? Why don't they support Ohio? Why don't they support, you know, the other states that border Michigan? This is what I'm talking about when I speak of a lack of organizational structure mm-hmm. and vision. There's wonderful people involved in the anti-war movement. I've met many of them. They always ask me, well, you know, how can we be more effective? And that's one of the main reasons why I wrote this book, is I said, you know, so many people have asked me that question, I feel an obligation to respond. And therefore, I responded by putting it down in writing. They can reject it, but, you know, that's okay. Read it, reject it.
The book is...
But if you're going to reject it, come up with an alternative. And then the book succeeded.
Waging Peace is the book, The Art of War for the Anti-War Movement. Scott Ritter, we just have a couple minutes left. Have you ever been on Bill O'Reilly's show?
I've been on Bill O'Reilly numerous times.
He usually asks. I've barely ever even seen it. But he usually asks, and I've seen him ask some anti-war movement, do you want the U.S. to win in Iraq? Because in Chapter 3, The Art of War, you quote George Orwell, the quickest way of ending a war is to lose it. And did Bill O'Reilly ever ask you that directly?
Do I want us to lose the war in Iraq?
No, did Bill O'Reilly ever ask?
No, what I'm saying, ask me that question?
Yeah.
I wish he would. I hope somebody's listening. They call up his producers and say, have Scott Ritter on and ask him that question.
Go ahead.
My answer is, we lost the war in Iraq when we invaded Iraq, Bill. It's not what I want. It's what reality is. The fact is, we went to war for illegitimate purposes. This is an illegal war of aggression. We violated international law. We violated the Constitution of the United States. Due process was not served, Mr. O'Reilly. And therefore, I want a war that we are losing to come to an end so we can save as many American lives as possible.
Interestingly, in the appendix of Waging Peace, you have the U.S. Constitution. Why is that in your book?
Because every organization has to have a center of gravity, what they stand for. And what I say is that if you're going to be an American movement, you better stand for the Constitution. After all, it is the document that defines who we are and what we are. Sadly,
very few Americans have read the Constitution, and even fewer Americans are conversant in the Constitution. How can we expect people to stand up and defend their Fourth Amendment rights against illegal searches and seizures, which, of course, warrantless wiretapping conducted by the Bush administration is, if they don't even know what the Fourth Amendment is? How can they defend what America is? How can they hold their elected representatives accountable, people who take an oath to uphold and defend the Constitution? How can their constituents hold them accountable if they themselves are not conversant in the Constitution? So a cornerstone of my book is the issue of the Constitution, making the values and the rule of law set forth by the Constitution the anti-war movement's values, and therefore easily transferable to the majority of Americans, and then to make it easy for people that say, well, I haven't seen the Constitution in a while. Wham, there it is, Appendix A. And because I want the anti-war movement to have broader appeal than just the United States, I put in the Charter of the United Nations as Appendix B, the document that defines how the international community is supposed to interrelate with one another. And because, you know, Article 6 of the U.S. Constitution says any agreement that our country has entered into that's been ratified by the United States Senate, two-thirds majority or more, becomes the supreme law of the land. Our Constitution and the Charter of the United Nations are linked together.
Well, I want to thank you.
They have to be treated as a single foundation of law.
I want to thank you so much for being on the broadcast. Scott Ritter was one of the United Nations top weapons inspector in Iraq, and he was also an officer in the U.S. Marine Corps, a ballistic missile advisor to General Schwarzkopf during the first Gulf War, and his latest book, and he has many out, do a Google, or as Bush says, go to the Google and you will find it all. Waging Peace is the brand new one from Nation Books, nationbooks.org. Waging Peace, The Art of War for the Anti-War Movement. I'll have a direct link to the book on my site, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. Scott Ritter, as usual, thanks for being on the broadcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
Looking out there!
The pictures, the podcasts, the blogs,
the special features you just can't get
anywhere else.
Super f***ing cool.
Get them online at WRIF.com.
I feel real just that.
Or check us out at MySpace.com/WRIF.
Guaranteed to be extreme.
Because we can always use more friends, and we won't be naked.
Does anyone else smell Astroglide?
101.
WRIF.
People are sexy and clever, and they always say something funny right before a commercial break.
Everything that rocks.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. When I began as a talk show host quite a few years ago, one of the big topics always was welfare. And people calling in and saying, those welfare cheats and those welfare queens. And I saw women driving up to welfare offices in Cadillacs and all that. If you're as old as I am, you remember that drill as well. If you're a lot younger, welfare in many ways has disappeared as a concept from the national political dialogue. But it has quite a history in this country, and particularly in the 60s and the 70s, where the National Welfare Rights Organization, which was the largest membership organization of low-income people in U.S. history, set forth on a path that's quite interesting. Writing a history of it is Felicia Kornbluh, and her book is called How Poor People Themselves Fought the War on Poverty. Felicia Kornbluh teaches history at Duke University. She's written for many publications, including The Nation, Feminist Studies, Los Angeles Times, Women's Review of Books, Journal of American History, and In These Times. She's co-founded Historians for Social Justice and is a longstanding member of the advocacy organization, the Women's Committee of 100. We're reaching her in Amherst, Massachusetts. Felicia Kornbluh, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Hi, I'm glad to be here.
Now, am I right that as a national issue, what so roiled the body politic in the 60s and 70s has kind of gone underground?
Well, that's absolutely right. And I think that that's really happened since the 1990s, because President Clinton and the Congress, the Republican-controlled Congress, together created a major welfare reform that was completed in 1996. But the story that I'm telling in my book is mostly a little bit earlier than that, and the story I'm telling is sort of about how America got set on the course that ultimately led us to that 1996 welfare law. So I'm talking about a period in the 60s when there was a lot of agreement that we needed to do a lot of things to alleviate poverty, to ameliorate poverty, even including expanding the welfare system. And then by the 1970s, really the tide had turned and welfare had become a very unpopular, contentious, fractious issue. And I think that set us on the course that we're still on today.
Well, take us back to the 1960s. Beginning in 1960, there was a seminal book whose name goes right out of my brain, but that rediscovered that there was poverty in America. Do you remember the book I remember?
Michael Harrington's Michael The Other America?
Yeah, thank you. And people were shocked that amidst Pax Americana, that this where everything seemed right, that there were these pockets of migrant poverty, urban poverty, rural poverty. And so we were bound and determined to get rid of it. We declared a war on poverty. As soon as the word war gets in there, you know, because we didn't know that then, that it's going to be a problem right away. But tell us about the war on poverty and the intent of it.
Well, in a way, the war on poverty, I think, was spurred precisely by the fact that America was so wealthy in that period, and people, as you're saying very correctly, people were really drawn to the contrast between the incredible wealth that we had after World War II, especially in the 50s and early 60s. You know, especially for people who lived through the Depression and through the war, this country seemed so, so wealthy, and yet that we still had this persistent poverty, some of which had to do with racism and other kinds of discrimination, and some of which just had to do with the structure of our economy. And so starting in the late 50s among some intellectuals, and then starting in the Kennedy administration in the early 1960s, and then on to the Johnson years later in the 60s, there was an idea that we really needed to use the government in a very active way to address this contrast. And one piece of the puzzle was expanding the welfare system, which was a system that we had inherited from the Depression period, from the 1930s, expanding it to cover more people and to eliminate some of the what people saw as the mistreatments of some recipients.
It was very punitive, and what people got was oftentimes food in kind. They would get this surplus agricultural stuff, and it was pretty much of a disgrace to be on welfare at the time, to be sure. A real social stigma, because if you were in the richest country in the world, why are you on welfare, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. People felt like it wasn't just that they wanted to get more money, but people felt like they needed to be treated with more dignity by the system. And interestingly, there were a lot of people who thought that they should get rid of the conventional welfare system and instead move to what they called a guaranteed income system, which would eliminate a lot of the bureaucracy and a lot of the inefficiency in the system, but it would allow people to be kind of insured against the worst excesses of poverty, the most extreme kinds of poverty. And there were a lot of people in the 60s who believed in that, people in the government, economists like Milton Friedman, the conservative economist, and John Kenneth Galbraith, the liberal economist from Harvard, as well as women who were on welfare and who were tired of the intrusions and the inefficiencies in the system. You know, they sort of agreed together, they united on an agenda for what they called a guaranteed adequate income that would protect them against the worst poverty.
Felicia Carmel, you raised the issue of racism then and now. The majority of people that are poor in this nation, of course, are white or Euro-American. Yet poverty so frequently is viewed as African-American. And in your book, How Poor People Themselves Fought the War on Poverty, and you talk about the National Welfare Rights Organization, that was a predominantly black organization, of predominantly black women, right?
Yes, it was. Although, interestingly, the women who led the Welfare Rights Organization were always very quick to argue that poverty and welfare were not simply black problems. They were coming out of the civil rights movement, and these were people who were they were sympathetic to and they were inspired by the civil rights movement, and some people had really been part of that movement, but they felt like that movement really needed to expand. And if they were going to talk about economic justice and they were going to talk about poverty, that they would be talking about white people as well as black people. And so there were always white people who were in the Welfare Rights Organization, and there always was a very consistent focus on poverty as opposed to race as the central or the only thing that people saw as the political problem that they were attacking.
You know, in this country, our tax structure has always been pretty low compared to, say, the northern Scandinavian countries in Europe. But people there see they get an enormous amount back. I mean, a country that doesn't have a lot of social problems, has a guaranteed health system. So when people faced, as I said in my introductory remarks, when tax-paying, particularly white males, saw what they saw as their tax dollars going to these poor black women who they, I guess, thought should have had jobs, their social ire and their individual rage was incredible. Can you talk a little about that perception?
Sure. Yes. It's a somewhat hard thing because on the one hand, it's true that that poverty is not just a black thing and it never was, and welfare is not just a black thing and it never was. However, it's also true that of the people who receive those kinds of public benefits, they're disproportionately African American and Latino or Latina, and that's actually because of the way the benefits are structured. There was a time when there were a lot more European Americans receiving those kinds of benefits, but the benefits were changed at the federal level so that, for example, older people, poor older people, a lot of whom are, you know, older white women, for example, who don't have husbands to rely on and who don't have retirement savings to rely on, they were sort of moved into a different system. So they're not in the same welfare pool. And the same thing with disabled people. Disabled people now, they receive what are called SSI benefits, Supplemental Security Income benefits. They're in a different pool from what we call welfare. So to some degree, it's a definitional thing. You know, the people who are receiving the stuff that we call welfare happen to be disproportionately black and Latino. But in part, it's a product of the way we've defined the programs. And it's sort of a historical accident, the way I see it as being trained as a historian. It's kind of a historical accident that it wound up that way. And so I think what happened was that people got very angry when they saw this program that was disproportionately black and Latino, you know, and said, well, my tax dollars are going to these folks who aren't like me. But people were sort of misaiming. A lot of people were kind of misaiming their anger, I think, because, you know, it's not that black people or Latinos are the only ones who are getting government benefits. They just happen to be the ones in this particular program, this thing that we call that we call welfare.
Well, the real welfare, of course, is, I think the point's been made a lot of times, is corporate welfare and all of the private welfare to individuals and families just paled beneath what the kind of breaks that corporations got. But that's another story. My guest is Felicia Kornbluh. She's written The Battle for Welfare Rights, Politics and Poverty in Modern America. It's published by the University of Pennsylvania Press. You can go to upenn.edu/pennpress. I'll have a link to that on to the book, and you can also get it at amazon.com. I'll have a link to that on my website, Peter Werbe, werbe.com. One of the things that, of course, really irked people that were tax-paying, hard-working people, and that was, you know, sort of the way they characterize it, and to some extent, or to a large extent, correct, was they also saw able-bodied men, as they saw them, who weren't able to find jobs, and they were heavily represented in the welfare. I'm sorry, they weren't heavily represented, but they were in the welfare roles, and yet in the National Welfare Rights Organization that you chronicle, the men didn't play the role that women did. How do you account for that? Why was
it's a good question. There were never that many men in the pool of people receiving benefits. Usually then as now, men who are unemployed, if they're not getting unemployment insurance benefits, they're getting, you know, state level benefits called general relief or home relief or general assistance, something like that. And the numbers are relatively small. The benefits are pretty small. I think there were men who were in this movement, but statistically there weren't that many men in the pool of people getting benefits, so they weren't going to show up in the movement as much.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I think it was kind of a different demand for women who were mothers, and those are most of the members of the movement. They had a specific kind of agenda as mothers, and they were really asking for benefits that would allow them to raise their kids at a level of decency and dignity, even if they, the mothers, were not able to work full time and to make enough money to raise their kids. And that was an agenda that a lot of African American, Mexican American, Puerto Rican, and white European American women could agree on, right? That it was legitimate for them to get some help from the government when they were raising young kids.
Well, I know that often when I'd get these people that said, you ought to kick all these bums off of welfare, and I said, well, you know, the vast majority of people on welfare are children, mothers of these children, and the disabled. So they're the perception, and that gave rise to the social anger was really cockeyed. And also, I would say to them, and I'm, maybe you could speak to this as well. And I would say what I said earlier, that, you know, that the corporate welfare, and I did list all of these tax breaks and the way that our tax dollars are invested overseas to help corporate investments overseas. I said, that's where your money's going. And they go, well, yeah, I'm against that too. But they didn't raise their ire. Didn't get them angry the way they had these visions of a woman pulling up in a Cadillac and getting their tax dollars and going home to to drink whiskey. I think a lot of it, we were kind of talking about that earlier, a lot of it was racist perception, racist social myths. Wouldn't you agree?
Yes, I think that's right. I also think there's something I write about in my book a lot, which is about how Americans think about how it's appropriate to spend money. And I think there was kind of a debate below the surface in America at this time when the country was so affluent and felt so proud of itself. We all felt, Americans felt so proud of the country for being so affluent. But there was actually a lot of debate about how people were going to spend their money and what ways it was appropriate to spend money. And those debates kind of spilled out in the welfare context, but really it was coming from other places. Like, is it okay to have certain goods? Are these goods luxuries or are they necessities? You know, what kind of food, if you're a poor person, what kind of food is it okay for you to eat? Should your kids have new shoes to wear to school or are old beat up shoes okay? Should you be allowed to get new appliances, for example, or should you have to buy used appliances? And, you know, and that, in part because the country was so rich and it was so new for so many people to have access to the consumer society. I think it made a lot of people uncomfortable, the idea that the poor people or working class people would suddenly have all this stuff. And even if they were receiving government benefits, that they would have all this stuff that poor people had never had before.
Tell us, if you would, Felicia Kornbluh, let's go back 40-some years to 1964, President Lyndon Johnson, with this great wave of liberal sentiment, the civil rights movement in full measure going on at the time. And so the war on poverty is declared. And so, and when was the National Welfare Rights Organization formed? Is it at the same time, essentially?
It's just around the same time. What I see is that in the early to middle 1960s, so right in that period, like 1963, 1964, there is a lot of talk coming out of the civil rights movement about the economic piece of that movement. And in large measure, that's happening in the civil rights movement in the North, or civil rights movement in the cities, in cities like Detroit, and cities like New York City, which I write about a fair amount. And so there's that conversation coming out of the civil rights movement, and then there are resources that come from the federal government, from the war on poverty. And so there's energy from the movement from below, and then resources from above, from the war on poverty. And together, I think those things provide the opportunity for the emergence of a very active poor people's movement, and one piece of that is the movement for welfare rights. So you see the first local groups in various cities around the country in 1963, and then by 1966 they form a national coalition, and by 1967 there's a fully fledged national organization with a membership system and all that kind of stuff. So it's happening all through that period.
Well, why would they feel it's necessary if the federal government signs on to a realistic war on poverty, and people felt that it was really that period, thought there was a new day emerging on lots of different fronts? Why would there have to be a parallel citizens organization as well? Were they satisfied with the scope and the depth of the war on poverty, the National Welfare Rights Organization people?
Well, no, they weren't satisfied. What people wanted to do was they wanted to participate in that war on poverty, which was in part a war that was about getting poor people involved in politics and involved in the democratic process. So part of it was people coming forward. The federal government says, we want you involved. You know, we're going to establish, we're not only going to give you money, but we're going to give you opportunities for democratic participation through, for example, community action programs, which were part of the war on poverty. So the federal government said, we're giving you opportunities for democratic participation. And people said, right on, that's just what I want. And so people came from the civil rights movement and they went right into active participation in those democratic councils and the war on poverty. But then they found that there were all kinds of blocks to their participation, and there were all kinds of blocks to them actually using the political process to have their voices heard and to get the things that they wanted. And so then I think that continued to drive people into politics, but then it became a more oppositional politics. It was like, okay, I was going to be part of the war on poverty when you gave me a chance to be part of it, but if you're not going to give me a chance to be part of it and you're not going to listen to me, then I'm going to go outside, and I'm going to agitate outside the door instead of inside.
Let us know what happened, if you would, to some of the participants. I know there was the not very pleasant phrase, poverty pimp, that was used, that someone would take advantage of a newfound public bureaucracy, and that rather than it being centered around the goals of the activity, was essentially interested in a job and not one that didn't accomplish very much. Was the National Welfare Rights Organization co-opted at all? In other words, taking people that were active and heartfelt and authentic and what they were trying to do and making them into giving them government bureaucratic jobs?
That's a hard question. I think maybe I'm not as cynical about it as you are. I know there were a lot of people who came through that period in time, through the middle 60s, especially African Americans, who I'm aware of, who went into electoral politics. People like Major Owens, who was a representative in Congress from Brooklyn in New York,
right,
sort of came out of the war on poverty structure. And some of the people in welfare rights also went into electoral politics. A woman named Roxanne Jones, who was one of the leaders in Philadelphia, became a state senator in Philadelphia until her death in the middle 90s. And so there were others who went into the bureaucracy, mostly city policy bureaucracy or into electoral politics, and they probably did dull their edge. They probably weren't as militant when they were inside those systems as they were when they were on the outside. But on the other hand, you could say, you know, isn't that what they wanted?
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know if I'm cynical so much as, well, we are talking about the war on poverty. Obviously, there's poverty has increased. The name of your book is The Battle for Welfare Rights, and that seems to have been lost as well, along with the war on poverty. Or do you not share my assessment?
Oh, yes, the battle. I did share your assessment. Yes, the battle was lost, and we still have a lot of poverty in this country. So I guess I would have to conclude that the war on poverty also was lost. But I think the war was lost mostly because we didn't really fight it with everything we had.
Well, there were, in your book, The Battle for Welfare Rights, you list that there was like 540 welfare rights organizations. And what's the picture look like today? I know there is still like one group left in the Detroit area.
Yes, there are local groups. There is less in the way of a national presence. But I do know that there's a statewide Michigan welfare rights organization that's active. And there is a National Welfare Rights Union, which has its headquarters in Detroit. And I know that there's a strong movement again in Philadelphia. I think it was quiet there for a while, but starting in the middle 90s, the Kensington Welfare Rights Organizations started to organize in Philadelphia, and they're still quite strong. There are several groups in the New York City area that I'm aware of. So they're dotted around the country. I think people are doing a lot of work, a lot of concerted work, and they're probably preventing a lot of cutbacks from happening. They're not really able to move forward a new positive agenda, but I think people are kind of fighting rear guard battles.
Well, I was going to say, it almost is back like we're back into the 1950s. Any moment I expect them to reinstate, commodity surplus. That was what they used to get. They'd get packages of flour and margarine and, big cans of beans and what have you. It was really something out of the 1930s when it began and was, heavily needed. But it certainly is today, and as poverty increases because of these great liberal icons, Clinton and Gore, the number of people on the welfare rolls has shrunk significantly. What do people do now that don't have the benefits of benefits?
Well, I can speculate about that. I think our data are not as good as they should be because the federal government, much to its shame, has not made provisions for collecting data about all the people who are leaving the welfare rolls.
This is purposeful, too. Yeah.
I think so.
Yeah,
I think so. The idea was, what happened in the 1996 welfare law was that a lot of incentives were established for helping people to get off of welfare or pushing people off of the welfare rolls. But there wasn't very much curiosity about what was going to happen to them afterward. So, we know some things. We know a lot of people are doing a variety of kinds of low-waged work. There are people working at the lowest rungs in the healthcare industry, people working as home health aides, for example. There are a lot of people working in food service jobs, which tend to be quite low-waged and tend not to have not to give people much of a ladder up. There's not much opportunity for moving up in terms of benefits or salary. A lot of people are, working two jobs, juggling very, very difficult schedules, and, of course, juggling difficult schedules with child care and taking care of their kids. And a lot of people are relying, and we know this from the other side, we know that a lot of people are relying on food banks, community food banks, and churches and other sources, because we know that from the food banks that the demands on their resources have shot up dramatically in the last 10 years. And that they can't handle anything like the demand that they're facing.
The book is incredible. It's a great history of people that took politics into their own hands the way they should, at the National Welfare Rights Organization, and it's a good look at that period as well, and suggests what we face today again. Poverty has obviously not been eradicated. The book is The Battle for Welfare Rights, Politics and Poverty in Modern America. Felicia Kornbluh has been my guest. It's published by the University of Pennsylvania Press. You can go to upenn.edu/pennpress. That's with two N's. And it'll also have a link on my website, peterwerbe.com, W-E-R-B-E, and it's available from Amazon. Felicia Kornbluh, thanks for joining me on the Peter Werbe Show.
Thank you. It's been great.
Listening WRIF.com.
Another dream goes up in the smoke.
WRIF.com.
Great call, San Francisco. Thank you.